Hi everyone, Matt here. This episode, episode 17, had to be split into two parts because basically Cameron and I covered the Orc Codex, which basically went on longer than we anticipated. So from a technical point of view, we've had to split it into two parts. So this first part will basically have our hobby stuff, our news, and about half of the main lore topic. And then part two will basically carry on where this part leaves off. And then we do our normal discussion topic at the end. So I hope you enjoy this one and don't forget to download part two. Do it now. Hello and welcome to episode 17 of Realm and Ruin, a Warhammer podcast. A podcast so Warhammer, we have an advert in Squig Hunters Weekly. Check us out. I'm your host, Matt, and joining me as always, a guy rumoured to be breaking off from the Tau Empire to form his own enclave. It's Cameron. How you doing, mate?
I'm doing well, thank you. Yes. Come to the enclave of, we have air conditioning, we've put all our fabulous pulse technology into air conditioning. It's the best enclave you'll ever be in. It stays cool, crisp, 18 degrees Celsius or below at all times.
It's a bit hot over there, mate.
Hey, summer's finally decided to get through the door after winter overstaying its welcome for a bit. It's been an interesting week with weather. It's been on, then off, then on, then off, then on, then off. There's nothing like it being 20 degrees or less for 2 days in a row, and then you step outside to get in the car to go to work, and it's 35 degrees. Ooh, and the sun is shining, ouch. And you didn't put the sun shield thingamajig on the inside of your windscreen, so your car interior is about 42 degrees. So you've got to drive around with the windows down and the air conditioner blasting for about 5 minutes, which is a third of the way to work. And then it's a mess.
Well, you can feel my pain because I think of the UK heat wave that we had to deal with earlier this year when we were, I think it was around the time we were recording the Soul Wars megasodes, wasn't it? I was there, I was melting at that time. So, it's unfortunately it's your turn, mate. But it's fine, you're here, ready to record.
I'm a little more used to it, at least.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Not us lily-livered Brits that can't handle our heat, unfortunately. Right, here we are, episode 17. So what we're going to be talking about. As always, we'll start with our hobby stuff, what we've been reading, buying, painting, and pretending we've been painting. And then we'll go into the news, which is probably a shorter little segment compared to last episode, because there's only been little morsels of news, but we'll go through those. And then the main bit of the show, as we've, I think, previously said on one of the previous episodes, is we're going to go through all the lore from the Orcs Codex and, you know, chuck in a few rules and standout moments. So we're looking forward to that. And then at the end, we've got our discussion topic where basically we're going to ask the question and go back to the world that was and say, is there any particular characters or heroes we would like to return from a, like from a lore perspective into Age of Sigmar that's not already here? Okay. So that is our episode 17. Get ready, get strapped in. So before we start the hobby stuff, two little things to say. As I said on last episode, we have started a way for you to support us, which is on a website called Ko-fi, as in Ko-fi. We've had a few donations, which is greatly appreciated. Thank you very much for the people that have done that. Like I said, any donations or support we get will go straight back into the show, you know, the costs of supporting the site and, you know, for future codexes, books, and anything we want to cover. So it's all greatly appreciated. The link will be in the description as well. And one quick little shout out to one of the guys on our Discord server, which is Peter, also known as Dr. Robotnik 83. Just to give him a quick thanks because he has taken on the lovely task of sorting out the Realm and Ruin Secret Santa on our Discord server, which is really cool. Unfortunately for a few people, it's a UK only one because it's the only shipping, way of really doing it.
It's a bit
exactly. I just thinking we've got a £10 budget and if I was teamed up with you, Cameron, I dread to think what postage that would go up to if I had to do it. So it's like I said, but no, thanks to him for, you know, deciding to take that task on, and yeah, thanks very much. Right, okay, let's get stuck into the hobby stuff. Yes. Cameron, what have you been doing, sir?
So when last we left our heroes, the story of Cameron's hobby continuing. I just built a Death Guard Chaos Lord out of a Plague Surgeon kit. Update, he still looks really good, but secondary update, some folks on Reddit very kindly but very persistently informed me that a Power Fist and a Bale Sword is not an amazing loadout for a Chaos Lord. And they're right. Right. They're right, but this was also the day where it suddenly got extremely hot, and so I was feeling a little limited on patience, and I said, F it. Every option then. Screw it. If he can't have those two things, he's going to have everything. I still have a bunch of magnets left over from the Knight Project, still ongoing, but doesn't really need any more magnets, luckily. And I still have most of a Chaos Terminator Lord sprue, and it turns out the new Death Guard Plague Marines are about, especially the Plague Surgeon model, is about the right size for a Chaos Terminator Lord's arms to look roughly to scale when put on.
Nice.
And so I've got my little hobby drill, I got my little pack of hobby green stuff, a knife, and some magnets, and I gave that boy so many options. he's currently sitting here outfitted with a Power Fist and a Combi Melter. I could swap that out for a Combi Bolter, or for a Bale Sword, or for a second Power Fist. We can Marnius Calgar it and have dual Power Fists here. we've got a Power Axe as well, and I believe that's technically the limit, but that's six arms to switch between, three right, three left.
it's like, you could say it's Christmas come early for him.
It's Christmas come early for him.
He's gone from having a very weak loadout to have what you want.
Yeah. I still have a few more options to sort out for him, because there's more things on the list that Chaos Lords can take. So I need to sort out Chainswords, Chain Axes, Power Mauls, Bolt and Plasma Pistols, and Lightning Claws. And then he will be complete. And I can give him anything I want. And I won't have to listen to people online telling me my loadout was bad because I thought the miniature looked nice.
Don't give in to peer pressure, Cameron.
I gave into peer pressure in the correct way, in that I used it constructively and grew as a person. but no, look, thank you to those one or two people on Reddit who were persistent in telling me that a Power Fist and another close combat weapon isn't a great loadout. I knew that. He looked cool. But now, he's even better. Thank you. I mentioned getting a old Death Guard upgrade kit and an old boarding squad kit on eBay last time. Those arrived yesterday, so I've been making good use of them, and I extremely trimmed down the shoulder pads on the Chaos Terminator arms that I've put on the Chaos Lord, and I've jammed the pauldrons from the Death Guard upgrade kit onto there. So now he has his correct little shoulder pads. They're a little small, but they look like they fit, and so that's fine. Whatever. So yeah, I'm pretty happy with how he's looking. I'll be putting pictures up on Twitter probably after the show or during one of our breaks. I'm not sure which.
Go for it.
Yeah, something I totally forgot that I ordered, because I forgot to mention it last week because it had completely slipped my mind. Along with those two upgrade kits, the seller was also getting rid of three Plague Toads secondhand, the big Nurgle Toad models from Forge World.
Mm.
So those were a welcome surprise in the box that I forgot were meant to be in the box.
what a treat.
It's like a little gift to myself. And those models are lovely. I've got one in front of me right now, and it is ridiculously detailed, which means, of course, it's going to be painted mostly with washes and dry brushing, because that's the only way to do a lot of detail right, obviously.
oh, they look amazing. Sorry, I'm just on the Forge World website.
They are.
Oh, wow, they're cool.
They are awesome.
Did you get all three of them?
Yeah, all three. Which, they were only asking like $15 for the three of them, plus the extra $5 postage. I'm like, yes, excellent.
That's really good, because they're 50 quid over, eh?
Yeah, so I guess someone just wanted to get rid of them. And yeah, they're nice models as well, because they're only three or four pieces each. Because you've got the main body, and then two of the limbs will be separate, and then on two of them, the horn is also separate. So I've already put them all together, I've green stuffed any gaps. They're not stuck on their bases yet, because I actually have some good detail under the body that I want to be able to see a little. So I'll probably, when I base them, raise them up a little so you could technically have a peek under. And I'll also paint the undersides. But, you know, I realize them. They're chunky little guys. They're not as tall as I thought, but they're a lot wider.
That's one way to describe them, yeah.
Yeah. You know, if I were to judge them based on the Plague Surgeon model, they come up to about his shoulders in terms of height, but that's because they're very squat. In terms of width, they're about a plague surgeon wide, meaning if I lay the plague surgeon model on its side.
Is that a unit of measurement now?
Yeah. Well, meaning if I lay the model on its side from head to toe, that is how wide the frog is.
I'm sorry, I just got this image of going into GW when they release a new knight and you go, yes, but how many plague surgeons is that in size?
It's a new unit of measurement.
It's not going to be 12 inch or 8 inch or anything when it comes to rules. Yeah. It'll be number of plague surgeons. Yeah, so I'm going to charge 2 plague surgeons length. That's great. Man.
Yeah, sorry. That's the only thing I had to compare it to. Now that I look around me, I do see a ruler just over there, but I would have to get up to get that, so no.
No, it's fine, mate. It's fine. No, that is a legitimate unit of measurement.
So these models are really lovely, and I'm really looking forward to painting them, especially because... So, last time I mentioned, I had built 3 melee plague marines out of a potential 20. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned in particular one that was acting as, like, a little suit, a little mecha for a Nurgling who was piloting his beat-up, blown-up body, effectively. It would have been 2 shows ago, I'm pretty sure, I mentioned that it was my store's birthday, my local Games Workshop store's anniversary of opening or whatever. One of the events they have on is a month and a half long, effectively, because it started mid-October and it's running till the end of November. It's called The Time Warp. Where you dig up your oldest, cruddiest model that you can find, and you put it in a lovely display case they've set up in the shop just for this purpose. And then during November, you paint a new miniature, and you go back to that display case, and you put your newly painted miniature to show just how good you've gotten next to your old, cruddy miniature. And I did not realize what a difference time has made in my regards. Like, I don't focus on painting a lot. You know, I paint because I like things to look nice, and I do enjoy it coming together, especially if it's a nice, easy scheme, like I can bang it out quickly and it looks good. That's great. I did not realize that my stuff actually looks all right. Some would call it tabletop quality, which compared to
easily.
The very first...
I would say so, mate, because like I said, looking at that Plague Marine that you posted, I think you've done a fantastic job on him, to be honest. I mean, he really stands out, because let's be honest, when it comes to the Death Guard especially, there's a lot of Death Guard out there. You know, when you're going on websites, when you're going on Twitter, you're going on Reddit, you know, there's a lot, you know, same with normal Space Marines. They're from a 40k point of view, they seem to be the most 2 common things that you see out there, because obviously they're part of the Dark Imperium box set, so naturally, you know, a lot of people have them, and obviously they're cheap on eBay, etc., etc. And when it comes to Death Guard, I get to the point now where I'm thinking, yeah, that's a really good job, but they look all the same now. They're starting to literally morph all into one. And I think what you've done with your particular Plague Marine, I think you've done just enough. Well, no, not just enough. You've done more than enough to make it stand out. You know, I just like the way, you know, like the way that the Nurgling pops in it and et cetera. I just think, like I said, you've just done a really good job. I mean, I saw one, I think it was on Reddit. I can't remember. It could have been Twitter. I saw it with a blue, like a lightish blue color scheme for the armor with purple, and it really looked good. You know, again, there was I don't think there was any bit of green at all on this Plague Marine, but it still looked disgusting in its own way, if you see what I mean. I think I think you've done a really good job in that sense.
Thank you. Like I said, I'm not the world's best painter, but I'm pretty happy with how I do. But comparing it to this ancient gene stealer from when I first got to 40k, I suddenly realized just how far I've come, and this is my moment of appreciating me. I'm doing all right. It's good.
that digital pat on the back.
Yeah,
well done.
Pat myself on the back. And also, I really like the comparison between those two, because it's a comparison of how far I've come in converting as well. Because you all know me, converting is probably my favorite part of the hobby. I love building something and then making it unique and making it definitely mine. Like, I have plenty of models that are stock standard as they came, but I will never repeat those. If I get the same model again, I'll make sure it looks very different. And so that old cruddy gene stealer, and this is how you know I love converting. This was the first model that I could find. I converted it. I got, I clipped off scything talon blades and stuck them on the shoulder like little air fin things, like almost like little wings. Just because I thought it looked cool at the time. I was like, God, like 12 or 13. I was like, yeah, this is the coolest thing ever. Put these things together. I apparently didn't know mold lines existed, because looking at that model, it has like 1 or 2 millimeter high mold lines on certain parts of it. I'm like, oh, God.
But the thing is, sorry to interrupt, but I remember when I was younger that, I mean, admittedly, it was more metal back in those days, but ultimately, you didn't often care about those sort of things, because I think as a kid, you don't, you know, well, again, back in the day, I don't remember the local store ever teaching me about mold lines or, or even filing and things like that. Whereas now, you know, as an adult, and now back into this hobby, you know, you obsess over it now. Well, I do anyway. You're like, make sure there's no mold lines. Make sure I've, you know, filed it down to a right edge. And then, no, I've filed it down too much. And, you know, and all that sort of stuff. Like, no, it's no battle damage. You know, and things like that. It's amazing how now, as an adult, you sort of, well, I do anyway, that you take more care into it. And I think there's a bit of irony in there as well, because obviously, as adults, we generally have less time. So we've got less time, and now we're putting more effort into our miniatures.
We want to make sure that the time wasn't wasted, so that it, you have to make sure it has to be perfect, Matt, otherwise failures.
That's right. No, but that's a really fair point, because, and I think we sort of touched upon it in the Adrian episode that we recorded a little while ago, that I do anyway, where you sort of feel a bit on show, like you feel like sometimes I probably do more hobby stuff than I let on to at times, where I'm building stuff or starting to prep stuff, but then I think, no, I don't want to show anyone that yet. I don't know, I don't feel confident, you know, and
it's not ready, and
really it's probably a silly thought, because probably people aren't thinking these thoughts that you've got in your head, because you're thinking, oh, I don't want to show it off, because people think, oh God, that's a load of crap, and when it probably isn't, and it, you know, it's I suppose because in a way, doing these miniatures, especially from a painting side, is a form of art. So it's showing off your art, isn't it, ultimately? Yeah. Okay, it's not your model, as in it's based on something that's been pre-done. But then, same time, that's probably why you like converting and kitbashing and things like that, because it's a way of expressing your artistic side. And therefore, when you want to expose it to people on the internet, because that's the best, or people in your local store, is you want to make sure that's right, or at least to have a standard that you're happy with, isn't it?
Yeah, again, that's why I'm really happy with this event, because my Gene Stealer's got his little aerodynamic fins, and then there's this completely customized Plague Marine next to him with, you know, custom arm positioning, a custom head, a little Nurgling sitting and piling him in the chest cavity, and I'm like, I'm really happy with how I've done, and I've come a long way, and I can see it all in this one shot with my name misspelled fantastically, which, hey, I love my Games Workshop manager, he's great, and no one can ever spell my last name properly anyway without guidance, so I don't blame him for getting that wrong. It also protects me from identity theft for putting that picture up on Twitter properly.
it's your secret author name. And when some of the writing you've been doing, that's where you'll go Swarbuck under, Mac.
the secret author. I'm really happy with that and how that turned out. It's been great fun doing that. Okay, so I think that's my modeling hobby. So over to reading. I've finished Carcharodon's Red Tithe. What a good book. I'm glad you've
liked it. Yeah. It's really good, isn't it?
I'm really looking forward to jumping into Outer Dark. I just love the flavor on the Carcharodons. You know, they've all got these, I would say, Pacific Islander style names. You know, you've got Tenkaharangi and everyone like that. But they have such a unique flavor, not just in like the naming conventions, but they have these you know, tattoo like patterns over their armor. As they're more experienced, they get these marks of honor, these exile marks. The scouts are basically worthless, so they don't get a name, they get a number before they become a full brother and things like that. It was an awesome book, and it was lots of fun. And it was really fun because, you know, everyone always goes, why are there still so many Chaos Space Marines? It's been 10,000 years. They don't have a standard way of restocking their numbers or anything. I'm like, well, here's why. Because they act exactly like the Carcharodons. They go out, they capture as many prisoners as they can, and they turn as many as they can into Space Marines. And, you know, the rest they enslave or they ritually sacrifice because Chaos. But, yeah.
And that's what's quite funny about that book, because obviously they're both doing the same thing, but for slightly different reasons. But then it sort of begs a question, who's right, you know, in some way?
Yeah.
You know, ultimately, you know, because obviously you could see it from the perspective that the Carcharodons are doing it because, oh, we're the good guys and we just want more, you know, more Marines in our stock. But at the same time, the way that, you know, the way they go about it isn't fully foolproof. Yeah. And, you know, it's, but I think it's, like you said, it's such a great novel. The Night Lords are brilliant in it as well. They're lovely and evil, but then, you know, they got their own dynamics as well. And from memory, you got this really cool dynamic between, is it the Reaper Prime and the Librarian from memory? Yeah. They sort of have this, you know, bit of a funny situation. And I'm glad you've enjoyed it, mate, because it is a really good, really, really good book.
It also helps that right after I read it, I saw I think there was a Warhammer community article on someone's amazing Carcharodons army.
Yes, there was.
And good god, that was fantastic. And apparently they like that guy, and the author have spoken, and the guy's gone, this is how I pictured everything. And the author goes, you got it exactly right. So, God, they're really cool, and I can see why you got straight to making a kill team for them after reading those books.
I know we covered them in one of our previous shows when we did our favourite Space Marine chapters, but they're just something about them. And I'll be honest, it's that book in particular that really just inspired me. I just like the way they are. They just feel so different. I know you can say that for some other chapters, like if you read about the Space Wolves, for example, they go obviously drastically different to the Ultramarines, et cetera, et cetera. But there's something about the Carcharodons. There's just something quite unique where, and also I suppose the fact they've based a chapter on a premise, like you said, of the, that you wouldn't expect them to, you know, like I said, that Pacific Islander type vibe, you wouldn't expect to me anyway, you wouldn't expect a Space Marine chapter to have that sort of aesthetic and that sort of belief. But yeah, it's worked.
Exactly. it's great. I think, honestly, my favorite thing about the book is that duality between them and the Night Lords, though. Because the thing with the Carcharodons is no one knows exactly who their Primarch is. Nope. It is assumed widely that it's Corvus Korax.
Yes, that's right.
But, honestly, it could as easily be Conrad Kurz. You know, they have librarians. Their librarians are usually gifted with the gift of foresight, which is a big thing with Conrad Kurz and sorcerers descended from him. They are dead white with black eyes. Conrad Kurz was dead white with black eyes, but so was Corvus Korax and things like that. They operate similarly. Like, they also fit with, I think there was a section of the Raven Guard in the Horus Heresy or something that was cast out for acting much like the Carcharodons do, and that's the idea of where they came from. But I also like the possibility that they are one of these renegade Primarchs descendants that are still loyal successors, effectively. And, you know, we will probably never truly know, but if we found out, ooh, wouldn't it be cool?
Let's see.
Yeah. So I'm looking forward to reading the second one. I read one of those hot new little novellas, because Games Workshop's selling books $7 a piece, and you know me, I can't resist that. So I read,
they love people like you, Cameron.
It's $7 for a book. I know it's a little book, but it's a book. Books are good.
Damn right.
So I read The Bloodied Rose by Danny Ware. That's Danie, as in not Danny, so it's a woman, not a man. And that's about an order of the Sisters of Battle called the Bloodied Rose, which I think they actually showed off their rules in one of the Warhammer Community preview articles.
I think they did.
They get the plus one strength when they charge, are charged, or heroically intervene, I think it is. Something like that.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah. They're very cool. They're a very, very militant Order of the Sisters of Battle, which says something if you're very militant for a Sister of Battle. And yeah, no, it's a great little sort of mystery horror thriller thingamajig. It largely focused on a squad of the Sisters of the Bloody Rose, and I don't want to spoil it, but it's a good read. It's a good short read as well. I basically read it in more or less one sitting, because both of it kept me turning pages, and B, there weren't a ton of pages to turn, so it ended. I really like that length for a story. I picked up two more. I picked up Steel Demon and the one about the Dark Oath. I forgot the title off the top of my head.
War Queen,
yeah. And I'm really looking forward to reading both of those as well, because, again, nice little short story to just consume over a lunch break, basically. What else? I pre-ordered Blackstone Fortress because look at that thing. look at that thing.
Ah, yes.
and... Yeah, no, it looks really good. Like, the models are all built up in store. They're doing demo games at my local games workshop, which I haven't got one in, but that's fine, because I've been watching people play it on YouTube, because it's so good. God, just that Chaos Lord looks amazing.
The Traitor Guard looks fantastic. You know what? The set looks worth it for me, just for him. He is just... Mm. And I suppose when I see him, I just think of Abaddon. You know, I just think, you know, as in, he's, yeah. You know, think if they can do this with this Chaos Lord... Yeah. What, you know, if they re-release you know, Abaddon, what could he look like?
Exactly.
Gets me so excited.
It's going to be so good. So I'll be picking that up on Friday, so less than a week away. Ooh. Space Marine Heroes is also in town.
Yep.
And I remembered exactly why I deleted Overwatch from my PS4, because blind boxes of things get me going, apparently. So I bought 5 of them over the course of a week. Initially, sorry, I bought... Yeah.
Sorry, I'm just laughing. Just because that is what they're hoping as well.
Yeah, it's great. Exactly what they want. I'm playing...
Yeah, right, they're right. Heads. I just bought 5 of them.
Yeah. Well, you see, initially I bought 2 because I wanted to see what they were like. And they're really nice models, actually. So I'm really happy with them. I got the Marine with a bolter running forwards, and I got the Sergeant with chainsword and grav pistol. So cool. And then there were 3 boxes left in the shop. And there were 3 guys left in the shop, and the manager goes, you know, the other shops have both gotten captains already, and we haven't gotten any. And we all just look as one at him, and he looks at us. And we just get one more each. and so from that, I got the guy holding the bolter with one hand and firing the bolt pistol with the other. So he's
called, oh, I love that one. Is that Garrus, I think he's called? I think.
Yeah, Garrus? Yeah, I think that's what he's called. He's got the really old pattern of bolter. Like the really unadorned plain one, which I really like.
Yeah.
That they have these different ornaments and armaments, I should say. And, you know, at that point I went, you know what? I should just make a kill team, really. I mean, basically.
See, this is why kill team's great. Because this is what people... It's this so is easy what to you do.
Yeah.
How many times you're thinking, oh, well, I don't really want to build an army of them. Oh, I've got a few models lying around. Or like you said, you bought 2 and you're thinking, well, if I have 5... I can make a kill.
It's, you can make a kill team.
It seems like every time we do hobby stuff, whether it's us or anyone else, it's the answer always is make a kill team.
Yeah,
that is the default answer for anything. It's great.
If you feel inspired to do something, but you don't want to commit to a whole army's worth of a project, do a kill team. Do like 10 guys. That's all you'll ever need for that game. Yeah,
absolutely.
And so when I went in yesterday to order Blackstone Fortress, I got 2 more. I got the other normal bolter dude who's just kind of standing there looking menacing, and I got a second bolt pistol bolter Garrus McMahon. But at the same time, someone else in the shop also purchased a couple and got a missile marine and the sergeant, and they already had a missile marine, and so I looked and it was like swapsies, and it was swapsies.
Yeah,
which is another aspect of this. It's fine. As long as someone else is buying one, you can always trade.
just loitering.
Just loitering.
Someone goes into the store and you're like, do you want to buy Space Marine Heroes? Do you work here? No, I just want to see what you get.
Yeah, I just want to see what you get. I mean, it's a real problem. Our store has produced no captains out of any of the boxes so far, and the other 2 stores in the city have produced 3 and 4, respectively.
Oh, wow. Okay, fair enough.
Which is really weird, and we're starting to think if Games Workshop HQ just isn't sending any to that particular store for whatever reason.
Favoritism, yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, I've got 5 little old-style Marines. I also got them because this is probably the last time Games Workshop will make old-style Marines, and they look really cool. But, you know, I've got five of them. I've got three with bolters, one sergeant, and one missile launcher guy. That's the start of a good kill team.
Definitely.
I don't know if I'll do them as a particular official chapter, or I'll do them as, like, veterans for my Archangels, which I've not really done anything for because Death Guard had gotten in the way. And go back, listen to the first couple of episodes, you'll hear all about that. Goddamn Death Guard. but yeah, I'm looking forward to having a play with those. They look pretty nice. And I picked up a set of the Games Workshop Clippers because everyone's talking sugar about them on the Discord. I went, you know what, Blackstone Fortress, I need the highest quality tools for these high quality, beautiful things. And they're really nice. They're really good.
They are.
They're a little expensive, yeah. But they're very sturdy and very, very sharp. I accidentally cut myself testing them. I just like ran my finger along the edge. I was like, oh, this is much sharper than any clipper should be. But
pleasing corn in the meantime as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Spilling blood.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that's more or less my hobby, I think. I always feel like I'm forgetting something. Oh, I ordered a box of Mark III Marines to go with the upgrade kit so that I
can build the rest lovely.
The best type of Marine. Yeah, exactly. So that I can build some more melee Marines. I found a really good tutorial for semi-true scaling them. It basically just involves sitting the torso up a little higher and lengthening the upper legs with some plasticard. So I got some plasticard.
Cool.
So I'll start working on that, and you'll probably hear about that on the next episode. But yeah, that was me. What have you been up to?
What have I been up to? Right. I have, right, hobby-wise, I have started building my Stormcast Eternals because I bought, like you, got Soul Wars quite a while ago, and then I expanded it by doing a bit of swapsies with Drew on our Discord server. So we ended up I gave him my Nighthawk troops. He gave me his Stormcast troops. So, and then I realized I was sort of totting up thinking I've got about 1500 points worth of Stormcast here. This is probably the biggest army I've got of anything. I was just like, hang on, why have I not really touched this? So, and I think also because of what I've been reading a lot of Age of Sigmar stuff, which I'll get onto shortly. I thought I really fancy getting stuck into those as opposed to doing stuff with Marines at the moment. So I've started building them, nothing of note particularly, just literally just started building them. Had a few issues with them. I've had to cut down the pegs a few times on some of the models, which is a known issue. It's not the end of the world, but ultimately it's still a bit of a pain in the backside to do. Again, like I said, like a lot of people doing, I'm just cutting the pegs down just to, because basically the known issue is that they have trouble basically fitting, coming together, and and then obviously you're having to get green stuff to fill in the gaps and all the hassle that comes with it. But so far, by cutting down the pegs slightly, it's pretty much solved that issue. I'm not having to really get any green stuff out for them. Again, I'm probably half a dozen to a dozen models in, so it's not that. We'll see as we get to some of the others, and I'm not sure actually. Remember, thinking back, I don't know if it was a batch issue because I think some people were having it.
Yeah, the issue, and some people weren't having a lot of issues. I put a few together and they were fine, but I routinely clip all the pegs off easy to fit miniatures as a habit. So
we'll see. I mean, because like I said, obviously why I say that is I've got two different batches, or potentially, because obviously I've got my version and obviously the models I inherited off Drew. So we'll see how that turns out. But I don't know what my plan is with them long term. As in, I'm trying to think of a color scheme because originally I was always planning for them to be a Renegade Stormcast group, really, as in not Chaos, but sort of going away from Sigmar. And so I was going for potentially a black and red scheme, but I don't know, I've sort of seen it a few times on other people's schemes and it's not really sold it. And that's no disrespect to those people because they've done a great job. But, when you see a scheme, you're thinking, oh, that doesn't look what I was hoping it would look like. So I'm a bit, I don't know. And there's obviously you're seeing a lot of people doing stone casts at the moment, doing those sort of rock and stone type features on them. I saw one that was like, I think they called them flame cast. They were like pretty much all black with flames coming out. So I don't know. I'm not sure where I'm going. I'm just thinking at the moment, I'm just going to build them and then I'll hopefully think of a scheme. My plan is to get a few more units for them. Predominantly, I'm thinking of getting a Lord Castellan. No. Is it Castellan? Yeah. What's the one with the Riffhound?
Yeah, that's the Lord.
He's a Castellan. Yeah, Lord Castellan. Yeah,
yeah.
Getting one of him because obviously he's a buff machine, and I'm thinking of getting a Lord Ordinator as well because I've got two of the blisters, so he'll go nicely with them. So I think if I get those and I get a few more Evocators and Sequiturs, I pretty much will have about 2,000 points. So
yeah.
So that's the plan anyway. So really, from an actual building point of view, that's all I've really been doing. As far as I can remember, but I have been reading a few books. So I have finished Soul Wars by Josh Reynolds, and I personally say thank you to you, Cameron, for recommending this book to me because it's bloody brilliant.
Oh yeah,
I really, really enjoyed it, and again, that's probably why I've got back into building my Stormcast. So
yeah,
it's I said for anyone that's not read it, definitely go out and check it. Spoiler. Well, sort of spoiler. We're going to be covering it next episode in advance. So, but it's really good. Again, and what I really liked about it is the fact that it's not just typical, oh, these are Stormcast, these are Nighthaunt, blah, blah, blah. It's, you know, the characters are great. Nagash is brilliant in it. Arkhan the Black is brilliant. And you're seeing, you get to see Stormcast in a different light at times, them questioning themselves, their memories, you know, all the things that we've asked about before, some of the things we've covered in previous episodes when it comes to Stormcast, you get a bit more information in this novel. So definitely check it out. What else have I read? I have finished Realm Slayer. I did that in a day.
Yep.
I mean, luckily it's an audio book, audio drama, I should say. It's about five and a half hours long, but what I would say is that the last hour is pretty much the cast being interviewed. So you've got obviously Brian Blessed being interviewed, like people like Toby Longworth is in it, obviously David Gaimer, the author, he's interviewed in it. So it's one of those books which comes to an end, you're like, oh, and then all of a sudden Brian Blessed is talking to you and talking about him climbing Mount Everest and things like that, and you're like, oh, okay, it's finished, is it? But it is a brilliant audio drama. Like I said, Brian Blessed was built to be Gotrek. He does it so well. All the other actors, I mean, to be fair, most of the other voice actors are people that you would be familiar with if you do read listen to a lot of the Audible Black Library books, like I said, Toby Longworth and people like that. I think John Banks is in it, etc. So no, definitely check it out. It's like I said, you can smash through it in an afternoon. And it's just great. And again, it's one of those where you think, I just want more of this. And what is brilliant about it, I would say, is, and this isn't really spoiling it, the way to look at Gotrek in this, imagine he is like an old Warhammer Fantasy player that's just been brought into Age of Sigmar. And he's like, what's a Dwarden? What's the Stormcast Eternal? Like, remember, he has no idea what these things are. And he's like, well, they look a bit, you know, naff. They look a bit crap. You know, he's like, and he's obviously criticizing, like, what the hell are this? You know, it's like I said, like, imagine someone that's been playing fantasy and then all of a sudden they didn't realize that Age of Sigmar is now a thing. And like, what's happened to my Bretonians? You know, it's like that, basically. It's really, really good. And lastly, from a book perspective, I'm in the middle. Well, yeah, I'm just over halfway through the Magos of, the last Eisenhorn book. And Excellent. Again, that is so damn good.
Oh, it's so good, isn't it?
It's brilliant. It is I'm listening to it, but it's so good. I mean, basically, it's the first half of, it's about, well, from an audio point of view, it's about 20 hours long. It's a big book. And the first sort of half of it is pretty much little mini stories about Eisenhorn. So exactly, and you know, you got ones with like Ravenor, and there's some fantastic little stories in there. I mean, they're all good, but there's some real gems in there as well. Like I really love that he's like a major Magos biologist. And he the one that teams up with a female Arbites called Max. He's in a couple of stories. They've got a couple. He's basically on hunting monsters, not wanting to.
Which is great.
Really good, really cool little. And then the second, I'm on the second half, which obviously is the novel, the Magos. I'll tell you next episode what I think of that, or my final thoughts, because it is damn good. And I think we've said before we should definitely talk about it in a future show.
Oh yeah, we have,
because it's well worth it. Right, video game wise, I've been carrying on playing a bit more of Inquisitor Martyr. The first sort of main bit of DLC's dropped for it, which is called Mind Plague, which looks to be Drakari based. So which is really cool. I mean, I was playing a bit of it last night because I neglected it for a few weeks and I sort of got back into it because it got a bit difficult. But what I'm starting to notice with the game, because again, for people that are not familiar with it, is like it's a 40k game, very similar to a Diablo type game, like an action RPG, obviously where you play an Inquisitor. But I'm noticing as I'm playing, because I've sort of got to a point where it's getting a bit easier, because I think it's quite difficult to start, but then I found ways of getting around that, and now I'm looking at the surroundings a bit more rather than going, I don't want to die. So what I'm finding really good about the game is, like I said, is scale, for example. Like, when you've got a Chaos Space Marine, which at this moment are mainly Black Legion, when they're running towards you, when they're right next to you, they are literally the size of a Chaos Space Marine compared to you as a normal human. You know, it's not like where you're the same size and it looks a bit weird. You know, you've got Nurglings running around your feet, you've got Plague Bearers going towards you. And what's really cool, because the game has obviously got a story, but you've got little side missions, and I think almost look like they're randomly generated missions. So like I was doing quite a few Nurgle ones last night. So you had a mission where you've got to destroy these big Nurgle shrines because they're pumping out loads of Nurglings and Plague Bearers and Standard Bearers and things like that. And it's just cool, you know, just blasting away with auto guns, last guns.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm a few levels away from unlocking bolters and, you know, and things like that. So, yeah, I'm really enjoying it, actually.
And again,
it's a game that you can just pick up and play because, you know, the missions can be, you know, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, they're all, you know, half an hour if they've got to be. So you just, you know, just get stuck in and they all seem to be a bit different. And you end up fighting, you know, like hell brutes and things like things you don't expect you're going to fight. So they've represented Chaos really, really well. Now that there's this whole new, you know, Drakari side of things coming into it as well. And yeah, I'm really excited to see what they're going to go with this game. So yeah, that's what I've been doing.
Excellent.
Video game wise. And lastly, buying wise, I bought the Orcs Codex, funny enough, because we're going to be talking about it shortly, which is a fantastic book to read.
So good.
It really is. It's definitely one of the better codexes I've read in recent times. And what else have I got? I bought the novella series that you were just talking about, but I was greedy. Yep. I bought all 10 of them. So
I left some for people to buy me for Christmas.
I was just greedy. I thought, I want them all. And I bought them directly from Black Library. And the good thing is you get one for free. You basically pay for 9.
Oh,
You know, and you get all 10. So it was £27 in the end. No,
wow.
Not even any postage. So I couldn't really argue for that. I thought, I've got all of them.
Fantastic.
So I've not started them yet, but I'm sort of hanging back because obviously we've, again, a little spoiler, we're potentially talking about putting a vote up, aren't we, where we may cover a couple of them for future episodes.
Yeah.
So I'm sort of waiting to see what...
Yeah.
Definitely. And again, they're lovely. And they're not actually, like we said before, they're actually quite big books for novellas. Mm. They're big. They're minimum 120, 130 pages.
Oh,
so
yeah.
So I'm looking forward to getting stuck into those. What else have I got? I also bought Sacrosanct and Other Stories, which is another recent AOS novel. Again, it's a collection. It's similar to Hammer Hal, but it's obviously a more recent version to obviously take into account the new Sacrosanct Chamber of the Stormcast and obviously, you know, Soul Wars and things like that. So, that's a good one because I think it only cost me about a fiver and it's a big book, you know. So, again, it's another cheap way of getting into your AOS if you're interested. Again, I've not started yet, so I can't comment on its quality. But if it's like Hammer Hal and what was the 40K one? Crusade, another story. So, if it's similar to that, again, it'll be really good. I also randomly bought the Start AOS, that book, the one that comes with the Knight and Cantor. It's like about £5. I bought it purely for the Knight and Cantor, to be honest.
Absolutely.
I just, I thought for a fiver. I mean, I've not, again, the magazine book thing that comes with it is on my shelf, so I've not touched that. But
I've had one for a month and a half. I haven't opened the magazine.
So I just thought, it goes on my shelf. I just want that Knight Encanter. So that's really cool. And going on the back of talking about Carcharodons, I've bought the Outer Dark as well, because that's the other one that I've not read yet or had a chance to read. So, that'll be really cool to get stuck into. So I've got plenty to read and, as always, plenty to build. So, that's been my hobby stuff. And before we finish this segment, we've got a nice little bit of community law needs its own little jingle. So a few episodes ago, if, I don't know if people can remember, but one of the lads on our Discord server, Squishy Pyro, who's a very big Orc fan, created a bit of lore, some custom fan fiction lore for his Splody Boys, as they call, where they were basically mixed up with the Iron Warriors. So obviously knowing this is a Orc episode, he obviously produced us a nice bit of lore to, you know, continue the story. So I'll just quickly read that out. So he says, I have an idea for my Orcs. Tell me if it is good. So during Iron Warrior target practice with their basilisk, the Orcs were blowing up Gretchens with the bubble chucker, but quickly wanted a basilisk because of its superior DACA. Good point. Iron Warriors agreed that bubble chuckers are what will give them an edge in space combat, you know, such as shield penetration. Just look up how bubble chuckers work. So the Iron Warriors asked some mechs to design them some bubble chucker ships, but the mechs wanted a basilisk and, of course, some teeth. Now, the currency that Iron Warriors recognize as ingenious, so is now widely adopted. So the Iron Warriors sent their best captain and sorcerer in Terminator armor, also my models, different story for them in my room lying on a page, to collect some teeth. So you get a strike cruiser landing on Armageddon for the sole reason of collecting teeth for the mechs. In the end, they created a tooth of Gaskull. Highly unrealistic, but fun to think of. So with teeth and a basilisk, the mechs make a bubble chucker for each ship, but they fell apart without the Orcs, like all Orc weapons. So they integrated a grot into each gun, like killer cans, and this is the reason for mysterious Space Hulk disappearances. The last thing they see or hear is the sound of Tesla coils heating up, and just the whole ship blows up. I like this story. Yeah. Spent the whole duration of my art and maths thinking and writing this. That is really cool. Thanks, Squish.
I do like the idea of Iron Warriors essentially imprisoning grots to man orc-made guns to make sure the gun keeps working.
Exactly. They're like, well, I'm not giving up. I'm not sacrificing myself. Let the grots do it. No, that is really cool. I like that. Mm. So like I said, Squish, if you want to give us more, we will continue this story of the Splody Boys and their Iron Warrior friends. Cool. So that's been the hobby section, and we're going to take our first little break now. And when we're back, we'll talk about what's been going on in the news. Back soon. Yay. Hello and welcome back. It's news time, everyone. Yay. Hooray. Contain your excitement. I mean, it's obviously difficult because obviously last episode we had Blood and Glory and all the news drops that come with it. Whereas this episode, news is a bit, you know, a bit shorter on the ground, but then that's not necessarily a bad thing because
no,
I mean, we think of our wallets at the end of the day. Right, actually, talking of wallets and one way you can destroy them, Blackstone Fortress is now up for pre-order, as Cameron hinted in the hobby section.
Yep.
So as of this recording, it's out next Saturday, and we're all very excited about this one, aren't we?
Oh, yes. It's out on Friday, actually. It's Blackstone Fortress
is it?
Friday. Yeah.
Oh, of course it is.
For Black Friday, yeah.
Hmm. Crude Move Games Workshop. You did well there.
It feels so weird having things come out on a Friday instead of a Saturday.
Hmm. Exactly. It's no, but it's such a good set, though. I'm just looking on the Games Workshop website. So it's £95 over here and whatever your equivalents are, which is the price that we sort of expected, you know, same price as Dark Imperium, Forgebane and all those sort of stuff. But, you know, you get a lot for your money, you know, 44 miniatures in there. You get all the tiles, the cards, the dice, the books, etc. And what I like about it is the fact that it makes the point that it's actually a board game for one person if you want it to be.
Oh, yeah, because I know
Adrian on our Discord server, he's looking forward to playing it as a solo game, and probably myself as well, who, you know, as someone that struggles to find people to play with at times, it's nice to be able to get a game like this and go, you know what, I'm going to play it by myself and still thoroughly enjoy it. So 1 to 5 players, really cool. And so is there anything particularly you're looking most forward to about it?
I mean, everyone has been all up in arms and super excited over the confirmation that one of the characters is a Man of Iron, which is pretty cool. For those who don't know, the Men of Iron were basically sentient AI robots that nearly destroyed the Imperium at one point. Hooray! there was more or less hunted to extinction, but UR-025, the autonomous robot from who is one of the heroes in the set, is actually a man of iron wandering around and pretending to be sent out by Magus Biologus. and to prove this, has slapped an Akilla on its chest armor, not realizing, as Adrian or Red Shadow on our Discord pointed out, should really be a Mechanicus cog, not an Akilla, if he's been sent by the Mechanicus.
Ah, good point.
I don't think it was a Magos Biologus that it said sent it, but yeah, that's the thing, is it's pretending to be part of the Imperium, but it's not doing an amazing job. is pretty cool. Like, just all the hero minis are so cool. I am honestly probably most excited about the Chaos Marines and Traitor Guard, because,
yep,
I mean,
definitely.
Look at them. God, they're so good.
Look at them.
Oh, they're just so good. Like, there have to be new Chaos Marine and new Traitor Guard sets coming in this style. Hopefully with more posability and options. But yeah. You know, this is the thing, is like, Warhammer Quest Silver Tower came out and had some really cool minis in it, and later on those minis got multi-part plastic kits, which I believe was the first Sangor or something like that were in Silver Tower. Mm-hmm. I mean,
it's a good way of testing the water, isn't it, well, because ultimately, I mean, let's be honest, if they released new Chaos Marine kits like this, people would gobble them up, to be honest, because they're so needed at this point. But, you know, from Games Workshop's perspective, they still got to test the water a bit. So ultimately, if they can see the hype that's coming from these, I know, obviously, I'm not saying people would purposely buy, or that many people would purposely buy Blackstone Fortress just for the Chaos Marines, because that would be a bit expensive, to be honest. But at the same time, if they still read the comments, they still read the hype that, you know, on all the websites and YouTube and things like that. So, you know, if they see that people are absolutely loving these Traitor Guard and these Chaos Space Marines, it's almost like a green light for them, isn't it?
Yep,
okay, let's get on with it then. You know, let's get them out.
You know what really excites me? This Chaos Beast.
I think of many things, Cameron.
Many things, but these Chaos Beastmen, because I'm just looking at the 360 on the website, and they're really cool looking. But also, Beastmen in 40K, please. Yes. We know they're there in the lore. The Death Guard Codex mentions Pestigors and stuff like that.
Yep, that's
Bring
right. Yep.
Yeah.
Oh, the possibilities.
So many possibilities. There's Dark Mechanicus stuff. There's Rogue Psykers. The Rogue Psykers look amazing. I love them.
Thing is, you've got a situation now, just thinking about it, where this is out, obviously, coming out in November of this year, and, you know, is this almost a snapshot of what's to come 40K-wise in 2019, maybe?
God,
is 2019 going to be Chaos Marines, Traitor Guard, Beastmen in 40K, for example? You know, are they going to update some of the Eldar, like that new Eldar Ranger, for example? Are we going to have Rattlings? You know, things like that. You don't know. I'm not saying we'll get every single, like, a force or anything that's in this box, but you never know, because it's you know, because obviously they plan very far in advance. I wouldn't put it. Oh, sorry, I'm just looking at the that Chaos Lord. I'm just looking at his sprue.
He's so good.
I just love. I love his backpack. It's amazing. It's got so much. It's got so much intricate design on it. It's such a good model. Anyway, so that's Blackstone Fortress. Like I said, it's up for pre-order, and potentially by the time you listen to this, it'll be on the verge of coming out. Anyway, so very exciting times. Talking about else that's coming out, and something we hinted at, I think, last episode, is obviously now, again, up for pre-order, is the Warhammer Legends series that they're continuing. This is where they bring back for a set period. Is it 7 days or 14? I can't remember.
I think it's only a week, which is...
Yeah, I think...
They're putting the pressure on us, is the thing. I'm like, I don't need any of these, but I want some of them. I'm like, no, bad.
It's already
almost Christmas season. You don't need to spend more money than you have to.
So with the Warhammer Legends series, this is a way for that Games Workshop, giving you a week to basically pre-order these models that have previously been available, and then obviously once that window shuts, you can't buy them anymore. So again, it's the turn of Beasts of Chaos, which is obviously very appropriate, because obviously the battle tome has not long been out, and people are starting to build their forces. So some really cool, and like you said, Cameron, a lot of them are the old metal miniatures, aren't they?
Yeah, I believe actually everything in this is metal, except for a couple of bits in Gorthor's kit, which are plastic.
Yeah.
Like, you've got the Wargore Standard Bearer, who is a single piece metal model. I checked the description, which is impressive. And he looks fantastic as well. Like, these are old models, but some of them still look amazing. There's the Khorne Gores and Pestigores as well, which, cool. There's not a lot of different sculpts, but they look pretty cool. Even the old Beast of Chaos stuff is pretty rad. You
know? It really is.
They got the old school Chaos Hounds and things.
I like the Standard Bearer, the Wargore Standard Bearer.
Yeah.
That is just a badass model. It really is. So
I think my favorite is the Centaur hero, purely because he's protected by wearing a unicorn skull.
Nice. It's such a shame that you've only got a small window. I mean, I think we've said previously with Warhammer Legends, I think a week is not really enough. Yeah, I think to me, a couple of weeks, a month.
Yeah,
it just gives people paydays.
They do them like once a month and a half, basically. It feels like, you know, they're not doing them super regularly. And I understand like it takes time to get them set up, but give us more than a week. Don't put our wallet to the coals and say, spend it now. Do it.
Well, exactly, and it's a shame for people that for some people that have just obviously spent probably a potential lot on Beasts of Chaos, the new stuff, and then they're like, oh, you know, they've exhausted their money, and they're thinking, oh, but I want to buy these two, but I've got no money left.
Yeah, well, like, this is the thing. This is the first one that has actually come right after my payday. All the others, I've not had any money to spend on these, and now I'm like, oh. I would have liked to have some money to spend on the other ones.
Poor bank balances.
I know. God, this is probably for the best.
Yeah, that's true. Right, switching it up. Next 40K video game has now come out, which I think we mentioned quite a few episodes ago. I think it was not long after we'd started.
Yeah.
I think it was one of our first few episodes, which is 40K Mechanicus, which is obviously a AdMech-based game. Like a lot of 40K video games, it's turn-based tactical game, so, you know, a bit XCOM like. It's similar to probably things like, from what I've seen anyway, Death Watch, which you can get, which is not a bad game. And from what I can see, obviously, it, like I said, it is based around the AdMech, but obviously you're predominantly dealing with Necrons, which is cool little twist. Obviously, that plays in nicely with Forgebane.
Yep,
obviously, you know, the box set, which has obviously got both forces in it. And yeah, I mean, I haven't seen any reviews of it yet, but literally it's only just come out in the last couple of days as of this recording.
Yeah.
You know, it looks cool. You know, it's definitely potentially worth a punt. So.
Yeah, I think something I saw from the early footage, which, hey, might have been changed by now because that was beta stuff, but it sort of has that exploration thing, but you just choose a place on a map, and if there's an encounter, you go into like the top-down strategic view. But what I liked with that is if you went into a room, there wasn't a combat encounter. There was like a description of the room, and you know, you could choose various things to look at and stuff, which I like. I like how much freedom that has for really weird stuff, because like they don't have to spend all the time and the money animating this crazy thing. They can give you like a good atmospheric little description and still, you know, maintain their budget and keep the game flowing without every room having this, you know, minute long cutscene of some weird Necron nonsense happening.
Well, no, and I've seen it in other games. Like I said, I'm still working my way through Space Hulk Tactics, and they do something similar. When you're between missions, you're traveling through space, you're doing little investigations. It's like it's like on a map, so of sorts. So you're moving along different along a line. So you know, there's not much deviation from the path. But when you come across stuff, sometimes if you come across obviously Tyranids, then it, you know, bang, you go into a mission and you'll be fighting the Gene Stealers. Whereas if there's nothing there, like I said, you'll get a small bit of lore, like you found some artifact or something like that. You know, and it you know, helps your resources and things like that. So it's, it seems to be, you know, another thing, a theme that they're doing across some of these 40k related games, which is, like I said, a really good way, because obviously budget is always an issue with these, because let's be honest, apart from some of the real big 40 games like Total Warhammer, Dawn of War, Space Marine, a lot of these Games Workshop video games are on limited budgets. They're small studios with obviously, like I said, a small amount of budget, or reasonable small amount of budget. So, like you said, there's only so much they can do. So it's not quite cutting corners, but I suppose, like you said, because they haven't got that, they've got to put it elsewhere or put the resource elsewhere. So, no, I think that's quite a clever way. And who doesn't want a little bit of lore? Because sometimes you don't need a cutscene. Sometimes just reading a description is equally, is interesting. Yeah. So yeah, that is now out. As far as I know, it's PC only. I don't know if it's coming to the consoles. I've not... That's not definitely the news. I haven't seen any mention of it on the consoles, but that could be wrong. So don't quote me on that. But it's definitely on the PC anyway. So
yeah.
Right. Okay. What next? We've got Space Marine Heroes, which obviously we were talking about in the hobby section. And I'll tell you what was gutting yesterday. Remember I said to you that I was like, oh, my wife's going to can grab me one when she's in town.
Yeah.
And I was so excited. Like you, I was thinking, oh, it's like my own little loot box. And then she didn't go in town. So, bad mood for the rest of the day. I want my Space Marine time. Hero.
There's always next time, Matt. It's okay.
Exactly. But, you know, I know I've seen different opinions on this because, like I said, it does play into that loot box culture, which is always a bit of a funny area to be in. I mean, to be fair, I think it's one of those things where you just take a punt on it. I mean, you could be like you that buys five of them over time, but you know, it's something I would probably buy one or two of. And like you said, if you know people, you can probably swap them. And if you desperately want to have all of them, then, but go then for eBay. Some people, what?
They'll be on eBay, the ones you want. Exactly.
Exactly. And at the end of the day, they're not ridiculously expensive. It's a cheap way of getting a miniature. You know, they're £5 over here and whatever your equivalents are.
Like $9 here.
Yeah, you know, it's that sort of, I've got a fiver on me. Oh, I'll get one of those. You know, it's not, you know, because let's be honest, there's so much in this hobby that's very expensive. So it's just nice to have something where, and it gives you a little bit of a surprise. As long as you go in thinking you may get something you don't want. But to be fair, they're all pretty good and some are better than others, but you know, none of them are terrible. So, and to be honest, and like you said, use them for other things. Use them for kill team. Use them for whatever you want.
Yeah. So, well, that's a conversation I had in the store was like, sure, technically getting 10 of these is more expensive than getting a box of tactical marines and you have no options and no customization, but you're not going to get 10 unless you're going nuts over having to get every last one. Like, exactly. Like I said, I'm going in to build a kill team. I might get one or two more, but I'm not going to get more than like 7 because, you know, that's about what you need, honestly.
Yeah, exactly. And to be fair, it's quite... You know, let's be honest, with the way that numbers work with some of these box sets, you may be one or two short. You know, you're thinking, I want to build a kill team, but I've only got 4 Marines for whatever reason, because they're spare ones from other box sets or whatever. So if you think, that's enough to just, you know, top me up. I don't need to buy it. Whereas buying a whole box of tactical Marines may not be worth it for you. So like I said, it's playing, I suppose it's playing the game a bit, really, playing the numbers, you know, and like I said, having... one or two, you know, which only cost you £5 to £10 or again, whatever your equivalents are, it's worth it rather than spending, like I said, X amount on a full box. So, but they're there, you know, it's a novel little thing. Right. So let's switch up to books because there's been quite a few books that have been mentioned. Obviously we've mentioned, we've mentioned the novella series, which obviously you've got 3 of them. I'm greedy and got all 10 of them. I mean, the thing to note is they've made this a point of saying this is series 1. So obviously the good chance is we're going to get more to come, which
I want series 2 to be 10 more books, but following on from these as like sequel short stories.
Keeping
with the characters.
They could be that. I'll be honest, I think it'll probably be the opposite. It'll be just, it's ways of getting people into certain factions or certain universes, because obviously we haven't just got 40k and Age of Sigmar in there. You've got Horus Heresy, you've got there's a Necromunda book as well from memory.
Yeah.
You know, so it's, you know, we could have a Blackstone one. you know, at some point, yeah. You know, or like a little spin-off. I know there is a novel of that, but I mean, you could have another short novel that has connections to it in some sort of way. So, no, I think it's a good way of them doing it. And I think what I could see happening is obviously knowing that there was that Black Library submission window earlier this year where obviously people could put their fiction towards Black Library to be, you know, potential future authors. You could see potentially the winners of that maybe getting involved in this sort of stuff in the future, sort of, you know, where they're not, you know, to sort of test the water with them a bit. You don't know.
No, so,
but no, it's good. Very good indeed. So what have we got next? So yeah, so again, from the book perspective, we've got the Black Fortress novel. I didn't realize that was actually going to be a thing.
Yeah, no, neither.
Blackstone Fortress, yeah.
I kind of don't want to read it. for a very particular reason, we didn't mention it specifically, but inside the Blackstone Fortress box is a sealed envelope with instructions to only open the envelope and see what's inside once you beat the game. There's like a little campaign system where you've got to go get clues and fight strongholds, which are essentially super tough combat encounters, and once you do a certain number of them, you have essentially beaten the campaign and you get to open this envelope and see what's in there. Oh, there's a dog barking in the background, sorry about that.
That's given his opinion on things.
Yeah. I don't want to read this book before I open that envelope and find out what's in there. But I don't want to cheat and just open the envelope, so I think, logically speaking, I just have to play the game every day until I beat the game, and then I can open the envelope, see what's there, and then go read the book, obviously.
Yeah. No, yeah. I think that's... I mean, I'm not surprised. I mean, let's be honest, with a lot of these other box sets with, like, Dark Imperium, Soul Wars, there's always been a novel to accompany them, so I'm not actually surprised. For me, it just came out of the woodwork. I knew, obviously, with Blackstone Fortress coming out, but I didn't realise there was going to be a novel to actually go with it, because they sort of kept that quiet, or it felt like they did really anyway, so...
Well, all
so,
the hype was about the box. To be fair.
Exactly. God. But like, new Chaos Space Marines. What's that robot? And things like that. So no, that makes sense. What else we got? We've got Black Pyramid, which is the next in the Hallowed Knights.
Very
set. So that's the sequel to Plague Garden, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm very excited.
I love
the Hallowed Knights. I love all that stuff with them. They're all so good. Like, it's Josh Reynolds, isn't it?
Yeah, he knows what he's doing.
He writes the best Stormcast that there ever are in any of the AOS stuff, so I'm super looking forward to Black Pyramid.
Yeah.
Plague Garden was amazing, so yeah.
And at the moment, again, I know this is all time dependent when you listen to this, but the obviously on humblebundle.com where you can buy the audiobook collection. So basically it's way for people that are not familiar with Humble Bundle, it's a way of where you basically pay a certain amount of money which can go to charity, which does go to charity, and you can sort of decide how much of it goes to charity, etc., and then basically you get a collection of things. In this case, you've got a selection of Black Library audiobooks, and Plague Garden is in there. So
yeah,
you know, that's definitely worth getting.
Yep.
Yeah, because I'm ready yet myself, so I must get around to doing that. Actually,
you're in for a treat.
So it's on my to-do list. So yeah, so that's the sequel coming out. Again, continuing with AOS, you've got Warclaw, which is
continuing with Josh Reynolds. That's a busy
time. He's smashing them out. So this is the sequel to Spear of Shadows, I believe,
which I loved
as well.
Yeah, also very good.
So, whereas I think this is an audio drama, from what I remember. I don't think this is actually a book, from
hopefully
gather
turn it into a book. But
yeah, maybe
drama I can also live with. Yes.
Yep.
Looking forward to it. So so this is because I remember I was talking about the Spear of Shadows book. Like the series is 8 Lamentations, and these are 8 weapons forged by Khorne's Master Smiths. One was the Spear of Shadows, and I guess this will be about the one called the Warclaw, which I'm interested to learn more about. I'll probably pick that audio drama up.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. I mean, actually, it's funny. I put Spear of Shadows on my Christmas wish list, actually. So hopefully I'll get that, and then hopefully I can then move on to that one when it comes out. So, no, that's really, really exciting. Right, what else we got?
The War Masters coming out on paperback, which I don't know if it was already out, but it's Gaunt's Ghost. They're good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I must admit, I've never read any of those yet. I must admit,
I've read the first one. I just need to finish all the 50 others of them.
So the thing is that the one that's got a lot of books in it? Like it's massive.
It's got a lot of books because it's got multiple arcs, and each arc has multiple books. And you know, Dan Abnett's been writing these for like a long time at this point.
Mm. Yeah, true. Yeah,
but you know, they're a cool squad. I love the Gaunt's Ghosts, and I really should get around to reading all those books. There's so many things to read.
That's what I said with Eisenhorn, because like I said, I only got into Eisenhorn this year, and like I said, I'm now obviously on the last book, and I would say it's probably my favorite series so far. My favorite collection of Black Library books so far. I absolutely love them. So I think that's the same with Gaunt's Ghost. It's one of those series I want to get into, but I thought it's almost like I've got to convince myself to do it. You know, I don't know. I will do it at some point. But the next one on the list I'm very, very excited about, which is Wild Rider. Now, Wild Rider is the sequel to Ghost Warrior, which is the part of the Rise of the Inari series. And I love that first book. I know you haven't read it yet.
I've not read it yet. I should get around to that.
Definitely. Yeah, again, that's my recommendation. Yeah. See, this is what we're going to do. All episodes, just recommend books to each other. and realize we've got not enough time to read them all.
Yeah.
But no, Wild Rider looks really cool. I mean, like I said, Ghost Warrior, I thought was fantastic. It had, like I said, some people were a bit meh about it, and I was a bit surprised at that, because I thought it just fed into this whole Inari, you know, current 40K timeline thing. And it was nicely detailed. The story was good, and to me, more of that, please. Wild Rider looks like it's gonna be really cool. So yeah, fingers crossed that carries on that line. Right, what else we got? So another sort of slightly different topic is that obviously Warhammer Adventures is still on the horizon, which is obviously that controversial series that's based for kids.
I don't think it's
controversial. people made it controversial. I know I totally agree. I think it's a good thing, but if you remember back in the day when it was announced,
I remember
it was, people were kicking off, or certain people were kicking off about it. So it's we'll call it the infamous Warhammer Adventures.
Yeah, that might be on the horizon.
So what is really cool is it's been announced that David Tennant and Billy Piper are going to be doing some of the voices for this.
For the audiobook versions.
Yeah, which is really, really cool. I mean, both of them were in Doctor Who.
I'm into that.
So yeah, I mean, I'm going to horrify people, but I've never watched Doctor Who, so so I don't. But I mean, I'm familiar with both of them anyway. So so no, that's really cool. And again, it's continuing this sort of theme with Brian Blessed in Realm Slayer, where they're getting big names, they are big names. I suppose it depends part
they're
of the
very
world you're
big
from.
Names.
Yeah, you know, so it's really good that they're getting these people on board. Because I imagine one of the hardest things is to convince these people to believe the situation. Because, you know, I would imagine when Brian Blessed came in to be Gotrek on Realm Slayer, he probably didn't know much about Warhammer. I don't know, but
that might have helped the performance.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, he probably just played himself. Brian, just do your usual stuff, mate. but you know, it's same with like, you know, David Tennant and Billy Piper, is that I suppose Warhammer, because Warhammer is its own thing. I always get a bit nervous when sort of famous actors come in
it can always be good. We got the Ultramarines movie because they got John Hurt in for that, and that was a variable reception. I'll say.
Exactly. Yeah. And wasn't Sean Pertwee in that movie as well?
Yeah, he was too. Oh, God, I thought he was in that.
Yeah. I've got no issue with famous names being in it, because it's great, because it brings profile to it. It's just, I'm always that, like, please do it justice, I suppose is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
I'm sure they will. I'm really sure they will. So,
It's good.
And again, it just shows this forward-thinking GW as well, that they're, you know, I mean, and it's no disrespect to the normal voice actors, because the normal ones are fantastic. I mean, like I said, I'm a big fan of Toby Longworth, especially as Eisenhorn. So, it's, but getting these names, let's be honest, it brings more attention, you know, to the hobby and, you know, the novels and et cetera. So, no, it's really good. Right, and the last little bit of news, if we want to call it news, because this, this is a bit of a contentious one. So, I think this was yesterday, there was a potential chapter approved 2018 leak that appeared online. It appeared, well, I found it on Bolter and Chainsword, and I think that was the main source of it. It was a screenshot from obviously a Facebook page of some sort, where they've, like I said, they've put some potential leaks. Now, this is a definite take it with a pinch of salt situation. I mean, when you read it, basically it's a list of, it's just some bullet points of potential things that they're going to, they are supposed to be in chapter approved, which obviously is on the horizon. We know that for a fact, that is coming out next month. That is definitely happening. I mean, it says that it's supposed to be coming out on the 15th.
Which, reasonable. Yeah.
Yeah. Could do. I mean, yeah. And you've got, you know, random things. You've got land speeders down to, you know, being 50 points, crisis suits over 30 points. The only, I think that what my only sort of concern with this sort of leak is the fact, the way it's worded. Because if, to me, if it was a proper leak, you would have definitive things. Like they say chapter approved for the 15th of December, approximately. Well, surely you should know that definitely. If you've, and crisis suits a little over 30 points. Well, shouldn't they be exactly 30 or 31 or 30?
Yeah.
Like, what does that mean? A little over 30 points. You know, that's not definite. You know, this, I mean, you've got interesting ones like the Sister of Battles Codex is supposed to be out for release next October, November.
See, that's the one that makes me feel it's not a real leak. Because Games Workshop never tells us when anything's coming out until a week before it comes out.
Mm.
And also, why would that be in chapter approved?
That is a very fair point. I mean, if you took it on face value, you'd think, oh, okay, that makes sense. Because let's be honest, with Sisters of Battle, you know, looking to come out, because they've never said they're definitely coming out in 2019. Because if you remember,
they
all
said
the way
Emperor
back,
Emperor willing,
yes, it's a we're hoping they'll be out in 2019. Mm. So realistically, the Codex coming out late, so late 2019, i.e., about a year from now. That I can see. That's a plausible thing. But like you said, I can't believe how a leak would know that. To be honest, the rest of it is, you know, plausible, like, you know, plus 3 points on Shining Spears, because obviously they're very powerful on, you know, on the tabletop, so I'm sure they will get a points increase. Odd ones, like no change for Abaddon and things like that. You know, it's like, I don't know, I suppose, well, let's be honest, in a month's time, we'll know if this is a crock of nonsense or perfectly valid.
All I want is for them to make Marines better somehow.
I've seen
lots of things flung around for that, like, you know, let them re-roll save rolls of one against low AP weapons, or, you know, give them all an extra wound, make Primaris 3 wounds, whatever. But they need fixing, and it's probably not good enough to just make them a couple of points cheaper a piece, because then you just field 3 extra Marines per list, and it's like, I mean, they're good. Oh my god. Oh. Never mind, I'll talk about that next episode. You know how I said I forgot something in the hobby section?
I
forgot the biggest thing possible in the hobby section.
So, that's fine, mate. It's all right. You know, get your notepad, write it down.
Yeah,
remember
yeah.
it for a couple
remember
of weeks
that
time.
For next time.
And I'll hold you to it. I'm like, remember that rethink, that thing you got really excited about in the news last episode? Hit me with it.
Yep. Cool.
Oh, nice. So yeah, that's been pretty much the news. Like I said, it's been a bit less than last time, but that's not necessarily a bad thing, because I'm sure, like I said, this is definitely the calm before the storm.
Yeah.
And so we'll take our next little break, and then when we come back, we're going to get into the main lore topic of this episode, where we're going to go through the Orc Codex. Back soon, you gits. Hello, and welcome back, you beakies. It's time to go through the Orc Codex. I'm Chopper Matt, and this is Flash Git Cameron. As with his Blackstone Fortress pre-orders. so, as we said at the start of the show, we're going to go through the lore part of the brand new Orcs Codex that came out recently. We will touch upon a few little rule things, you know, as we towards the end, but again, predominantly like we've done when we've covered other battle tomes and codexes and things, we're focusing on the lore part of it. So we're, you know, basically going to summarize the sort of first half of the book. And yeah, it's good.
Oh yes.
I'll say that now. It's very good. Mm-hmm. So we'll take it in turns, like I said, like we've done before, to cover all these different parts and enjoy this orcish ride.
Indeed.
It's orc time. Orcs. That's what we like talking about. Let's start with the barbarous hordes about the orcs. Right. Mm-hmm. So, orcs would rule the galaxy. Really, realistically, if they did join together, they're that vast and that powerful a race, as we've, you know, said about before. Mm. You know, they're predominantly a war race, a race that's always looking for a fight. That's what we like to do, us orcs. Mm-hmm. We like to fight.
Yep,
and,
yep.
You know, even to the point that they like to fight themselves, you know. Yeah. And that's why they're quite an interesting race, because ultimately they're complicated, but predominantly they are very simple at the same time. It's all about fighting, really. They're not... They are about taking over things, but to fight, basically, not to, you know, not from some really weird ulterior motive or any sort of sense of, you know, accomplishment or like that. It's just looking for a good fight. So sometimes a war, which war is basically a predominant force of orcs that are brought together under one banner, so to speak, and, you know, cause chaos across the galaxy. So sometimes when they start one of these, it'll basically, if a certain orc leader makes it happen, that is as simple as it. They go, right, should we go for a fight? Let's go fight. And then off they go. So a predominant thing of orcs is they have this sort of, you know, phrase, which is might makes right, which really does sum them up. You know, that sort of means that they don't suffer from doubt. They're full of confidence, you know, especially from dominating their subspecies like the grots and things like that. And basically, one of the main characteristics is that, you know, they're ultimately stronger and tougher than most other races. That's a, you know, a big thing when it comes to the orcs. And like I said, they're a physically tough race. They suffer very little pain. You know, it takes a lot to bring them down from an injury and point of view. And, you know, to the point where that they find other races amusing when they're in pain themselves. You know, that's sort of the, you know, the mindset you need to get into if you ever wanted to get into the mindset of an orc, if you ever wanted to. But they can, you know, they can regenerate from heavy wounds. They can only be brought down by massive wounds, or the other way of, you know, realistically taking out an orc is to burn them. But, you know. So ultimately they're around the same height as a human. If they weren't hunched, they're muscular, strong, huge arms, huge hands, obviously green skin, which is obviously where they get their name from. Which is like a tough leathery hide. They've got huge tusks, big red eyes, big dupe booming voices, and things like that. So, but like I said earlier, they're ultimately a simple race. They don't, in the sense that they don't have any concerns. You know, they're not thinking of the bigger picture. They're not having to deal with, like I said, doubts and politics and things like that. It's just, right, what do I want? I just want to fight. I don't want to dwell, you know, they don't dwell on things. They're not there to blame. I mean, they will blame each other if a plan doesn't go together, but they're again dwelling on it. They just try another way. And often it's because they've forgotten the first time why it went wrong, which is a typical orc mentality. So, you know, ultimately the main needs of the orcs are someone to fight, someone bigger to lead you, someone to smaller that you can beat up and bully, and who's there to kill next. You know, and when it comes to things that, like eating, they can pretty much eat anything due to the where their digestion is. They're even prone to being cannibals. And again, another key thing about the orcs is there's no need for riches. You know, because ultimately they don't need to hoard it in the sort of, you know, in like a bank balance. You know, they're not having to go buy some more Games Workshop models. they just, all they want is bigger weapons and bigger vehicles. I know, I went there. And, you know, when it comes to the money side of things, it's the main currency is their teeth. And basically, because they shed them every few years, it just makes it, they adopted it because it's a simple way of being. Because ultimately, why bother with gold and all the other ways that you can have currency? Just use your teeth. You know, they fall out every couple of years. You know, you've got them on tap. It's the easy way of doing it. So
if you need more money, you go punch someone else in the mouth.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and that's the thing, and that's what it comes to, especially when we cover the bad moons, that, you know, just beat a fellow orc up, you know, because like I said, they like to fight each other, so they got no qualms about robbing each other's teeth. So so yeah, that's the barbarous horde. So yeah, let's talk about the Green Menace.
Yeah. Yeah, so you know, greenskins, orcs, they're pretty tough fellows. So is their society. It endures pretty much anywhere and everywhere. Orcs have been found prospering on toxic death worlds, newborn planets still heaving with volcanic activity, or in depressurized space stations. Orc tribes, you know, inhabit ice flows and irradiated asteroid fields close to stars. They've been found in chemical swamps, lightless nightmare worlds seething with horrific predators, kind of like a Riddick-style world, I guess.
yeah.
And they've even cropped up in the remains of worlds that have been subjected to exterminatus. Rogue traders have their own little horror story private rumor that there are orc tribes living inside the Eye of Terror, which I can absolutely believe.
Definitely.
Yeah. They're basically always a dire threat just because they multiply so quickly. If you find a couple of orcs just, you know, on their own, lost and abandoned, and you turn your back for a week, suddenly there's 50 of them. You turn your back for another week, suddenly there's a whole horde. You know, people aren't 100% on how orcs spread so quickly. There's the idea of spontaneous physical division. So once an orc gets big enough, he just splits into two smaller orcs, perhaps. There is the very popular among the actual Warhammer community theory of wind-blown spores that they release when they die to grow into more orcs. The Vandermeist theorem posits that orcs inhabit an alternative pocket of reality and simply fall through, fully formed, wherever other orcs are already at war. Which I love.
That's great.
Yeah. Basically, if you see one orc, there's always more somewhere nearby.
yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you let a few escape the wreckage of a crashed spacecraft and they run into a city's underhive. A week later, you've got a whole, you know, the beginnings of a war on that city's hands, and the city is about to fall. You know, if they don't kill you, they enslave you. If they don't destroy something, they loot it. And they, you know, basically just bring orcish society to everything they meet. They are very hierarchical. Basically, the bigger, the stronger, and the nastier you are, the higher your rank. Below you are always the Gretchen, who just kind of do whatever you tell them to. And below even the Gretchen are the Snotlings, even smaller and even dumber. But Snotlings are very useful, because they're very good at dealing with squigs and very good at growing mushrooms. So, yeah. But Gretchen in particular are intelligent, not strong.
Mm.
They kind of scurry around, they've got these big heads, and they are prone to malice. They're more hateful than orcs. Orcs do it because they enjoy doing it. The Gretchen will do it because they know you don't like it. they have an innate talent for self-preservation. This survival instinct in some of them is basically almost a spider sense. They have this sixth sense to, you know, help them live longer. If they're brave, they pull faces and make rude gestures at other orcs, but always behind their backs. You know, they usually, as part of an orc settlement, though, they'll set up, you know, scrap tunnels and things, you know, places where orcs can't actually reach them. So they have their own little mini society within a society, and they go out into the orc settlement to do things for the orcs and get resources and things. But when it's time, when it's time to go to war, the runt herds, which are in charge of, sort of herding grots into battle, either send a whole bunch of squigs into the tunnels to flush them out, or some enthusiastic burner boys get given the job of flaming them out of the tunnels. Yeah. and, you know, they're not dangerous at all by themselves, basically. They're these tiny little shrieking goblin things. But there's never just one grot, just like there's never just one orc. Interestingly enough, their most valued use can be in boarding actions in space combat. Because the orcs get on board of a spaceship and they go looking for a fight, and all the grots that came with them avoid that fight like the plague, which is smart. And instead, they just squirm into the air ducts and loot everything in sight, including ripping wires out of targeting systems and the air systems and things like that. you know, they wreck void shields or burst out of ducts to overrun ammunition supplies and things. They're not fun to deal with. There's snotlings, like I mentioned, their most valuable function is they just grow mushrooms. They provide food, drink, and medicine because mushrooms can be eaten, can be turned into booze, and can be turned into medicine. Snotlings usually live in the cesspits, known in Orc society as the drops, essentially, you know, the communal bathrooms.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where they breed all manner of ferocious squiggly beasts. Which I guess is the proper term for a squig, is a squiggly beast. and snotlings actually have a very natural affinity with squigs, which is very handy because it means only a few dozen of them get eaten each day, as opposed to all of them. yeah. And, you know, the snotlings are kept under control again by the runt herds, who use a variety of methods to bully them into a state of anxious obedience. it's a rough life at the bottom of the orc hierarchical pole. I mean, speaking of the hierarchical pole, tell me a little about Greenskin Coulter.
Coulter. It's like we're farmers talking over the fence. You got any of that Coulter? yes. So, like every race, you know, the orcs and greenskins need their own culture, and so like I hinted at before. You know, like I said, they got a natural instinct of violence. You know, they're simple, straightforward, no-dwelling race. And because of that, the origins of their actual culture is pretty much unknown at this point. There's, you know, they haven't really sort of found out. I mean, there's links to or talk of brain boys and things like that, which we'll cover a bit later. But, you know, predominantly, people don't really, or other races haven't really sort of cottoned on to where this has come from. But like I said, predominantly, they obey larger beings. Obviously, other greenskins, not other races, but basically, if it's a larger greenskin than them, realistically, they obey them. And like I said, they don't obey other races. They rather die than give in to other forces. They're led by war bosses, or their tribes are led by war bosses. And sometimes you've got a particularly strong war boss, they become a warlord, which basically is a higher up war boss that has a collection of tribes and different forces. You know, as you would imagine, the larger orcs are the ones who take control, obviously usually with force, because that's, like I said, that might is right mentality that they have. I mean, orcs will do anything for them, basically. You know, if you can prove your strength as a boss, a warlord, a war boss, or even just a knob, basically, that ultimately people under you, or the orcs under you, or the other subclasses under you will do whatever you want. So under the warlords or war bosses are the knobs. They're sort of like the next layer down. Like, they're basically predominantly larger orcs who control, in air quotes, the normal orcs. So you also then get a mob. Basically, a mob is a tribe that's going to war. The larger versions of mobs are war bands, which are led by a small war boss and a collection of knobs. And then you've got certain types of war bands, like goth ones, for example, which have huge number of boys because that's what they specialize in. I mean, orcs are pretty useless when not fighting, ultimately, because like you hinted at when you're talking about the Gretchen and the Snotlings, they're the ones that do that sort of work. So basically, like I said, the Gretchen will do the boring tasks like cooking and moving stuff and things like that, because orcs don't really do that sort of thing. Gretchen are used, you know, in this situation, they are used and abused, but but most of the time they are happy with this situation because they've sort of accepted that's the way of life. That is the hierarchy. Orcs will tell Gretchen what to do. So they sort of just, like I said, just accept that. But it doesn't mean they don't get anything out of it, because some will even do well out of it. You know, you get Gretchen traders, you get Gretchen gambling dens and things like that. You know, so, you know, ultimately, if they're like Cameron said, they're not stupid, the Gretchen, especially compared to the orcs. So, you know, if they can get onto a good thing, they will do. But ultimately, orcs are built to fight, whether they're larger or smaller. You know, whether the conflict is large or small, it is all about fighting. And what you can get, sort of weird situations where, like a prolonged war, for example, will make them literally larger and stronger as time goes on. You know, particularly, you know, like if you got situations like when we've covered Armageddon, obviously, which is a very prominent orc war, you know, where certain orcs end up being twice the size of a man. So they've literally doubled in height, because obviously they are roughly the height of a normal man. When they're not fighting, they do things like take on local predators, because why not? They'll fight each other, because again, why not? You know, and if obviously they're not fighting for quite a long time, you even get certain knobs challenging the war boss, you know, because, you know, why aren't we fighting, boss, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. So, you know, they are, they can be seen as quite a restless race, which sort of sums them up, because they, as they, like you're saying, they're always around in the galaxy. They're always not far away from an orc. So because of this, most orc settlements have fight pits, which is a bit of a no-brainer, really. You know, it's ways of resolving disputes and power struggles, which obviously naturally happen in this sort of culture. You get even more interesting things. You get squig-eating contests, for example. which is a great little situation where you try to eat the squig before it eats you. You get, or you've got racing, because obviously, as we know, and we're going to cover later, orcs like to go fast, so they often race each other. I mean, when it comes to adulthood, they obviously get into more violent fights. They get, and then what seems to happen, like you see in other races, they get stuck into one particular warfare type more than others during the fighting. You know, like they, i.e., they become specialists in something because something catches their fancy. Because
it's a bit different to other races, because they're like addicts to that kind of war. Whereas other races, like, I was trained to be a tactical marine. I don't enjoy it that much.
I suppose you're right, they're a very obsessive race. If they love something, then they'll love that more than anything that they do. So like I said, if they like to burn things, they'll become a burner boy, for example, because why not? I suppose it depends And I mean, like you said, I mean, I suppose in other races it can be different, because like you said, I suppose that like if you use the aspect warriors of you know, the Eldar, or I know, say actually use Space Marines as an example, where obviously they start off as a scout, then they become a devastator squad, and then they become assault marines, and then tactical marines. So they have to go through all the motions, whereas orcs will, you know, just be a boy, and then if they become a burner boy, they stick to doing that until they die, basically. But
which, if you're a burner boy, happens faster than not.
Very true, when we get onto that. And then what often happens, as you'd imagine, because they like we do, as we're Warhammer obsessed people, and we like to hang around with other Warhammer obsessed people, orcs like to do the same. They like to hang around with, you know, other orcs that specialize in what they do. So you have, you know, this is where groups of burner boys or storm boys or whatever you want to talk about, that's where they come from. I mean, the most popular being of those is the Cult of Speed. The Cult of Speed is obviously a group that love to go fast. Their primal instinct is, you know, it's basically like the fire of weapons and things like that. They, you know, they jump onto vehicles, any excuse to go faster and kill and shoot. I mean, even they got substandard vehicles because, you know, the way they build things, but ultimately they can still cause problems for their enemies. The real obsessed ones become speed freaks, where they use all manner of vehicles, and they've always got like mechs, which is their mechanics, on standby because as you know, things blow up, things break, you know, things need adding on. You've got other ones like you've got the Odd Boys, for example, that are basically they're known as a cast of technical orcs. So Odd Boys are sort of a collection of ones like Mech Boys, for example, which are, like I said, the mechanics. You got the Pain Boys, which are basically these very dodgy medics that they have. You got the Runt Herds, which are basically like the breeders, and then you got the Weird Boys, which are their form of psyker. But ultimately, the main thing you need to know with Odd Boys, which, like I said, is these collection of specialists, is that they know their craft without learning it. Ultimately, it's potentially passed down from the Brain Boys, which is supposed to be potentially the first orcs that come down from Gork and Mork, which is a very hazy bit of lore. But basically, at the end of the day, orcs are happy, because if they're not one of these specialists, they're one of the boys. And ultimately, they're kicking the enemy in and shooting and shopping and all these other things they like to do. So it keeps them happy. But obviously, you know, because of that, let's go on to the nature of them.
So there are a lot of theories specifically about orcs being a mix of both animal and fungus. This would explain a lot about them. You know, they could be green because there's algae that lives in their skin and blood, and could help break down and repair damaged tissues very quickly, which explains why they regenerate so quickly. One point of evidence for this theory is that an orc's head can live for a significant amount of time after being severed from the body, And indeed, a lot of pain boys have this as one of their sort of staple operations, is head switching. But overall, the one thing everyone agrees on is orcs are relentlessly bloodthirsty. Once they've attacked somewhere, they will just keep doing so. you know, and people need to understand this. And I'm talking about in the fiction, people really need to get this into heads. It's been like 10,000 years. you beat wave one of the orcs, that is not time for the celebration party. any orcs that ran off and survived are multiplying, they're spreading word, you know, they're like, hey, this place is a really good fight, we didn't beat them immediately. and so, you know, you basically end up with these waves and waves of invasions, with every time you beat back an invasion, you know, the survivors go and they spread the word, or they spawn new feral orc tribes out in the wilderness around the area. And, you know, a month later, there's even more greenskins ready to go. and, you know, the harder you fight back, the worse it gets. And, you know, a planet can unintentionally turn a simple orc invasion into a war by simply getting such a reputation for being a good place to scrap that hundreds of thousands, even millions of orcs show up and all band together and go on a crusade. and, you know, the Great Rift has sort of complicated this, because it used to be there was an option of, well, the orcs have invaded three times, we get the message, we should leave. If you're in the Dark Imperium, the Imperium Nihilus, you don't really have anywhere to go, and it's unlikely anyone's coming to help you. So all you can really do is get forced into this war of attrition that you can definitely not win.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, orcs are having a grand old time in the current era of Warhammer 40k, because Chaos is doing this massive assault across the entire galaxy, and what's better than jumping into a two-way fight and making it a three-way fight, you know? you know, a lot of times Imperial Bastions will barely repel a Chaos invasion, and then out of nowhere all these orcs just land and start attacking, and it's just awful. You know, supply lines are severed, worlds are overrun. You know, even if Chaos and the Imperium stop fighting each other for long enough, they're already beat up to the point where the orcs easily sweep through them. the orcs are having a good time. And, you know, it's basically heaven for an orc out there. So why don't you tell me about the orc gods?
Yes, let's get onto their deities. So as I mentioned earlier, we got Gork and Mork. So, I mean, when it comes to the gods, the orcs don't worship them in the traditional way that other races do, as in they're not there wasting time in their eyes praying to Gork and Mork and things like that. Gork and Mork would rather the orcs tear down the idols of the gods of the other races instead. You know, don't be there on your knees, just get on and fight. So so basically, to sum up Gork and Mork, Gork is brutal and cunning. Or, sorry, brutal but cunning, and Mork is cunning but brutal, you know, so, which is a fair point, you know, so I can summarize. Exactly, you've got to know these things. I mean, the interesting thing with Gork and Mork is that they, in essence, laugh in the face of the other gods, really. They can't lose, they can't be, in their eyes, they can't be destroyed. I mean, ultimately, when the sort of main way to differentiate the two gods is ultimately that Gork is more of the fighter of the two gods. I mean, not literally, but like I said, he's the more warfare one, whereas Mork is the more sneaky of the two gods. I mean, on the battlefield, you'll see them in the orc's image, which is basically gargants and stompers. These, you know, they're huge war machines are built in the image of Gork and Mork, and, you know, like a way of bringing them on the battlefield. You know, and I suppose in essence, the mech boys make them gods on the battlefield, so to speak. Yeah. You know, you've got things like Gorkonauts and Morkonauts, which are, you know, these suits, again, suits in mechanical suits in the image of these orcs, you know, where, and it even leads to the point where their wearers will start gaining the visions of these two gods as well. Because, you know, they will start getting involved. So when Gork's grin split the stars, i.e. the Great Rift, visions went through all the orcs all at the same time. You know, you had weird boys bringing things forward. And ultimately the gods were ready, you know, to enter, you know, from the immaterium. So,
which,
like I said,
yeah, Looking forward to that.
Yes, exactly. I mean, that's the thing. They've set them up ready. I mean, like you said, you were saying, Cameron, with the Great Rift causing a lot of problems. This is like a playground for the orcs now, with all this chaos that's been going on. Mm. They're loving it. And so are Gork and Mork, and especially with what they task a certain orc with later, which we'll get to. So, like I said, Gork is like I said, their god of war and fighting. You know, he's revered by their war bosses and the nobs, you know, predominantly, whereas Mork, like I said, is the deity of the odd boys, you know, that side of things. So, you know, providing inspiration, I suppose, in a way that they sort of considered the god of surprises. So you can imagine Gork and Mork, you know, they provide, you know, a balance in a weird way. You know, you've got the fighter and then you've got the sneaky one at the same time, which is quite interesting. So, shall we go on to their tribes and clans?
Yeah. So, orcs thrive on conflict, of course. The strongest, you know, end up in charge, and the people aren't so strong, they get beaten down and they get all the shit jobs. That's perfectly normal. That is very satisfactory. If your tribe is beaten by a stronger tribe, cool. Now your leader's even better, because this guy is way better than the old guy. Now, tribe is a loose term, because it simply refers to all of the orcs in any given location. Because, you know, in the end, an orc is an orc. They'll always put aside differences to stomp some yumis or some tau or whatever, basically. A tribe is usually led by the biggest, most powerful war boss around. They're, you know, vary in size depending on how successful the fighting's going at the moment, effectively. Mm-hmm. Now, the war boss can't be everywhere at once, so he has his sort of a ruling council of appointed cronies and local leaders who are also war bosses, but not quite as big or as hard, obviously. And they lead their own little mobs and war bands. However, that's the tribe. A clan is quite different, because a clan is a group of like-minded orcs. You know, they have this particular affinity for certain things, you know. Tribes always break apart and reform, but clans are always the same. And a large tribe will almost always have people from a ton of different... Well, people, orcs from a ton of different clans. Because, you know, it's just... It's like, I mean, there's always the comparison that orcs are football hooligans. But it's like... It's a bunch of football hooligans from England, say, going, you know, oh, Manchester U made it to the World Cup, but none of the other teams did, but we'll cheer for them anyway. Even though we're supporters for Liverpool and all the other ones. I'm sure it doesn't actually go like that. I don't know about sport. But
I'm enjoying your football knowledge there.
Yeah, look, I know two things. There's Liverpool and there's Manchester United. I don't know any other British teams.
Yeah, I got that impression.
Yeah.
You did well, mate. You did well.
Yeah, thank you. There are a ton of clans, but six sort of take the spotlight. You've got the Goths, the Snakebites, the Bad Moons, the Blood Axes, the Death Skulls, and the Evil Sons. You also have Feral Orcs, who are basically orc societies that have lost all knowledge of technology because they're the remnants of these broken wars or broken invasions. You know, they live out in the wilderness. They rely on primitive technology, like they have no access to guns or vehicles, like whatever's left is sort of a rusting venerated relic. But the problem is, as they get bigger and they expand, they'll come into conflict with any other, you know, sentient race in the area, and as soon as they kill a small settlement and pick up a lasgun, they go, oh, I like this, it makes a noise and it makes a bright flash and it kills things dead, and they've begun the jump to regaining technology in the tribe. and, you know, as they fight more and more and they acquire more and more loot, they turn from a feral orc tribe into just a normal orc tribe, which I think is really great.
That's awesome.
Yeah, they pass on from riding squigs into battle to riding trucks painted to look like their favorite squigs into battle and things like that, which is pretty great. But, Matt, how about you tell us about the greatest of all the clans, the Goth clan?
Yes, as Cameron said, these are the greatest of all clans, the most well known, the orcs orc, as they get said, which I think is great. They you know, I mean, they're the epitome of of orcs. They, you know, they love fighting. They're very much into getting stuck in, any excuse to fight. They're a very melee combat focused clan. You know, no mucking around with, you know, from afar with guns, just get stuck in. And because of that, obviously they thrive in mass numbers, as we've said before. And ultimately it's easy to get those numbers because, like you said, orcs like going to war. We've got a fight over here, lads. Yeah. Are you in? Yes, I am. And they come. And, you know, and it's the point that they'll go to war on foot, or they'll hitch a lift if the situation allows them. So the enemies of the Goths believe that the thunder of their boots is a tactic, but whereas really it's just a load of orcs following each other.
Yeah.
The fighting's that way, lads.
Yeah.
So, you know, and from an aesthetic point of view, they like to wear black because ultimately they don't want to be flash gits like, you know, like those bad moons. You know, just keep it simple. Wear black, you know, with a bullhead logo. Oh, that's a new word. Logo. Here with a bullhead, which basically is, again, to summarize them, charging into battle, you know, aggressive, hot-headed, you know, just like a bull would be. So ultimately, you know, they don't bother with things like camouflage. You know, they're prop, in air quotes, proper fighters. You know, no mucking around in the shadows. Just get stuck in. And under the banner, they, you know, they have the banner of Gork, which, like I said, when I covered the gods, that, you know, that's their fighting god. So again, it makes sense that they, you know, favor Gork over Mork, so to speak. The best Goths are the, what's known as the Scar Boy veterans, which, you know, basically the hardest and toughest of all their fighters. War bosses and knobs are generally the best around, as you would imagine. They've got the worst fighting pits, again, as you would imagine, because any excuse to fight. So, yeah. What I mean, if you want to think of an orc, you think of a goth. But in contrast, let's talk about a different type of orc. Let's talk about the blood axes.
Oh, no, we've missed one.
Oh, no.
Let's talk about the evil sons. You're the blood axes. I'm the evil sons.
Damn notes.
Sneaky git.
I'm glad someone was paying attention there.
So, hey, you remember hearing how the orcs like to go fast? Some of the orcs, they like to go really fast. And the best way to go fast is to go red, because the red ones go faster. So the evil sons are basically irresistibly attracted to vehicles. Not like sexually or anything, they just love going fast in cars. They love riding buggies, riding war bikes, or supersonic aircraft. They will spend every tooth they own to get a slightly shinier ride. Riches among them, you know, pay mechs to customize their ride, add more wheels, add bigger engines, louder rockets. Anything that looks like it might make the vehicle go faster is fair game. So often you'll see wings attached to war bikes, jet engines mounted on trucks, or even things like squeak treadmills or propellers. Which, God, I want to do... That's such a good conversion idea. Do a truck, but use the Skaven Doom Wheel, but put a bunch of squeaks in it.
Oh, that'd be amazing.
Oh, man. Oh, well, put that on the to-do list, I guess. Now, if an evil son's orc boy lives long enough, he will inevitably get his own ride, whether by buying it with some carefully hoarded teeth or just nicking it from another clan member. If he can't drive into battle, he will ride into battle. But if he can't ride into battle on a truck, at least he can be next to the engine and, you know, smell the stink of Promethium, hear the rumbling of the various engines. If they have to fight on foot, they do their best to get into trucks or battle wagons or run as fast as they can. they never stay in one place for long. They actually have a tendency to leave the battles halfway through if it looks like the fighting's starting to die down. What they really want is a good chase, somewhere where they can really open up the throttle on their vehicles. Enemy forces that retreat from evil sons often learn this to their misfortune, because that really just encourages them. They will even give them a sporting head start.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, very nice of them. Very polite. Now, it's really difficult to engage the evil sons from the Imperium's point of view, because every Imperium vehicle is kind of slow and clunky, and they're big metal boxes for the most part, you know, like Lemon Russes and Rhinos and things. And so the favorite tactic of evil sons' warbands when facing static gun lines like the Imperial Guard is to charge directly into the enemy line. And once you hit the enemy line, you keep charging forwards until you go all the way through, come out the other end, and then wheel around to charge again from behind. and you get these long columns of vehicles going in and out and in and out of the enemy line while, you know, the enemies desperately try to turn their static guns to try and catch them, which they just can't. Tau Hunter cadres and Drukhari raiding parties are a little put off balance by Evil Suns, because what enemy can normally keep up with them? Most things they just fly around, but then suddenly there's an orc riding a warbike catching up with them just because the warbike's painted red. their clan logo is sort of this blood red orc face grimacing from the heart of a sunburst. They wear red armor and paint all their vehicles red because red ones go faster. Apparently its roots are in the rituals of covering mounts with the blood of their foes, a tradition that is still observed with manic relish by some Evil Suns to this day. Lovely. Now, you sneaky git, you can tell us about Blood Axes.
Yeah, thank you.
You've got your ones on there. We alternate.
I know. This is the problem when you do notes like that and you just put the notes of what you're talking about, not what the other person is talking about. But hey, that was a very orky thing to do anyway, so yeah. I stand by that. let's talk about the Blood Axes. These are the odd ones. You know why? Because they use tactics. Tactics? Ugh. How unorky. They're distrusted due to their human connections, basically, because they will even look to trade with them. They use tactics that other races would use, like retreating, battle plans, and things like that, which obviously raise a lot of eyebrows. What other orcs don't realise is that the Blood Axes find it amusing to use human weapons against them. So even though they're trading with them and all that sort of stuff, is ultimately they're the ones getting the last laugh at the end. They're just using the humans to get what they want out of them. I mean, even to the point where sometimes Blood Axes will work as mercenaries as well. Most of the young orcs end up being Storm Boys, because in a way they become rebels by being disciplined. So obviously it's a bit of a flip of culture, really, because obviously, you know, that's their way of rebelling by being good and disciplined. So and even sometimes they become future trainers of these Storm Boys as well. They specialize in things like commandos, which are basically where Blood Axes use camo, as they no point getting shot, so let's camo up, you know, what's the point if you don't make it to the battlefield. Their war bosses, as you would imagine, are very understanding of tactics, covert ops, even utilizing, you know, combinations of different vehicles that work well with each other. And basically their war bands are combos of foot troops, vehicles, heavy guns, specialists. Because they believe in tactics and battle plans, they're not just like, oh, let's just have a load of boys. Let's have different troops for different things, you know, that you'd imagine other races doing. And they also specialise in what they call their battle wagon blitz brigades, which are basically their vehicle brigades that use strike and fade tactics, surprising enemies at the last minute. So, like I said, they're very unorky, but you know, it works. They get the job done.
Yeah.
So making sure my notes are correct. You talk about the boys in blue.
Yeah. So, orcs from the Deathskulls clan. They're cunning, light-fingered, untrustworthy, and insular, with a mean streak a mile wide. But ain't no one as good at looting as they are. They're plunderers without equal. They're talented at scrounging, stealing, and borrowing things from their fellow orcs. But they're very bad at giving things back if they've borrowed them. they have a higher than average number of mechs in their warbands, and, you know, a lot of them would make very capable scientists and engineers if their fascination with new things lasted longer than the time it took to get the new thing. from a Death Skulls point of view, a battle is a two-stage process. You kill someone, and then you take all their stuff. And you should make the killing them as fast as possible, because you really want to spend all your time taking their stuff. After battle, they go to work. They feverishly strip down everything. They take ammunition. They take everything from ammunition to bootlaces. They also take trophies, like scalps or skulls. But, you know, they're relatively peaceful with each other until they get back to camp and start fighting over their various ill-gotten gains. any other orcs that come to a Death Skull camp to look for a specific bit of loot to trade or something that was stolen off them during the battle, they usually leave with less than they actually came in with, because Death Skulls have this uncanny ability to knock someone around the head while also taking everything out of their pockets at the same time. They don't limit their pillaging to just corpses. They are adept at basically looting vehicles. This is an orc favorite. You see that thing we just blew up? We should put more wheels on it and bring it back. a lot of foes have been horrified to see one of their own vehicles midway through the battle start up again, turn around with an orc in the turret, and start fighting them. they use a horned death head as their totem, and this symbol is added onto anything they've stolen, borrowed, or looted to establish ownership. This is also involves usually painting the item blue, which is the luckiest color. You can use blue handprints or smears to stake a claim, and they use even blue war paint and cover themselves head to toe before a battle. Funnily enough, this actually seems to work. A lot of Death Skulls have bullets missing them by inches, while their own shots are actually incredibly accurate.
Mm-hmm.
So they have this very broad definition on what constitutes personal property, so their favored specialist orc unit is the looter. Which means they usually produce this unrivaled amount of DACA, all the better to break down enemy armor and vehicles into easily looted portions. Delicious. But there are easier ways to get things than stealing them. You could just buy them. So why don't you tell me about the Bad Moons?
Yeah, I'm going to talk to you probably about my favorite, I think, clan, because I've always liked the Bad Moons.
They're pretty
good. These are the, you know, they're like Cameron. These are the flash gits. With their
disposable incomes.
Yeah, and their free time. Bad Moons are the richest of all the clans. That, like I said, these are the flashy orcs that have got plenty of DACA. And predominantly that's because they grow teeth quicker than any other clan. But obviously that can be a downside, as we alluded to earlier, because you can get attacked for it as well. Just because you've got it, you know, it doesn't stop you getting knocked over the head and your teeth taken. But like I said, they grow them faster, therefore they get rich quicker. And often what you see is war bosses will sometimes use them as easy money. You know, it's almost like a walking bank, which is great.
Or make a deposit.
Yeah, exactly. Boom, smack them over the head, take their teeth. There's that new shiny little war buggy you wanted. So, this is great. So, as you'd imagine, they're seen as the merchant clan of all the orcs. They're all about buying and selling. It's also believed that they came up with the whole teeth currency, because, again, the origins of that is not really known. Or it's sometimes seen that they made, because teeth were made currency, they made them grow quicker. So it's like it's the chicken and the egg situation, basically, with teeth.
Bad Moon and the tooth.
Exactly. But ultimately, they rather knock out teeth rather than talking about this situation. So they just no one knows the true what happened behind it. So because of this, as you imagine, because they're flash gits, they're shown to be over the top. They wear gaudy outfits, they're covered in gold. I mean, other orcs rather would have teeth than gold, basically. You know, that is how valuable teeth is to an orc. So,
yeah.
And they're the epitome of that. And because obviously they're rich, they use better war gear. They use very customized weapons. They often have grot servants because they can pay them. They have big guns, again, because they got the money to pay for these things. So basically what ends up happening is grots end up using Bad Moons to their advantage and get rich. Like I said earlier, when we were talking about, you know, the Gretchen doing that side of things. Perfect clan to follow. Use the Bad Moons. Oh, yeah. They got money for days, throwing it around. they know what they're doing. So you often see them. Well, you always see them wearing yellow and black. Their symbol is a snarling moon logo. They're covered in jewelry and piercings. Anything. They're like the Emperor's children of orcs, basically. they just want to show off their bling if they can. I mean, ultimately, if they see something, if it's valuable, you want to show it off. That's what it's all about. And you know, even if it's ended up through your skin as a piercing or a trophy, or often it ends up being on their weapon, which is obviously the obvious place for it. So, So do you want to talk about some more traditional orcs?
Yeah, let's talk about snake bites. Very appropriate for the Australian to be talking about. like you said, these guys are sort of the staunch traditionalists of the greenskins. They're usually only a couple of rungs above feral orcs in terms of their actual technology level. But this never really holds them back. You know, They still follow the old ways. They spawn all these complicated technological gubbins. Jeez, I can talk. They prefer to put their faith in something like a good bit of sharpened bone, a heavy stick, or a keen edge chopper. They daub themselves with mud and war paint and hang claws and teeth from beasts and wear these poorly cured leather skins. So their color is primarily brown. They appear weatherbeaten and they're really tough, but their big thing as a clan is they are experts at breeding grots and squigs. Their grots and squigs are the artist and the most dangerous of all. And when they go to battle, they just bring this menagerie of creatures with them. Their camps are absolutely chaotic, you know, overrun with squigs. Their most famous pest de resistance, as it is the mighty Squigoth. Which is, you know, if you've seen a Squigoth model, you know what a Squigoth is. It's a giant orc elephant, effectively.
Yeah,
and when well-trained, they become almost completely loyal to their master, recognizing them by smell and serving as a living battle tank. Now, you might be wondering why they're called the Snake Bites. Mm. Well, when a young youth wants to become a boy, i.e., you know, he's 6 months old, he's grown up big enough to be a boy, he has to goad a serpent into biting him, suck out most of the venom, and then live. And, you know, they'll keep doing this throughout their life, gradually building up an immunity to poisons and venoms, and every new world they come to, they bring plenty of snakes with them, just in case the local wildlife proves disappointingly inoffensive. Snakes nice. Make the best pets. The more aggressive, the better. Yeah, and their runt herds also cultivate these massive hordes of Gretchen, who in times of war are given weapons and herded into battle to, like, man artillery batteries and things. Ironically enough, unlike the Bad Moons, where the orcs have all the best gear, in the Snakebite clans, grots have all the best gear, because the orcs don't want to bother figuring out how to work it, and so they just throw it off to the grots. Great. Yeah, and so while the grots are busy, you know, handling all these technological marvels that they've managed to cook up, the orcs are just gathering in these big surly mobs, chanting and working themselves up into frenzies, and sort of, eventually, their main battle plan is to bury the opponents under this avalanche of orcs, squigs, and grots. They're low-tech, but they're definitely still very effective.
Nice.
Would you like to tell me about some freebooters, some of those odd exiled orcs?
Yes, let's talk about the pirate class of the orcs, because why not? You've got to have orc pirates.
Oh, yeah.
It's meant to be. Yeah. So, like Cameron said, these are the exiles of the orc race, which end up becoming these sort of mercenary war bands that, as you would imagine, they're all focused about the loot. They're, like I said, they're orc pirates hunting for vulnerable ships, you know, basically in their own smoking and quite debatable ships that they're basically traveling in, you know, sailing the sky, basically looking for more loot and more fighting. So, like I said, these orcs are basically being either kicked out from other tribes or are often the sole survivors or a handful of survivors from tribes that have been destroyed and obviously have really nowhere else to go. So they often become freebooters due to the warp and the Great Rift making them either mad or mad boys as well. So that often plays into it as well. They're generally shunned by other orcs, but again, for being quite unorky and lacking in their tribal duties, because obviously as they become freebooters, they've often lost whatever tribal, you know, aspects they had, you know, prior to that, and they sort of ended up being quite neutral, really. So they find the biggest freebooter to become the war boss, and off they go to cause a bit of mayhem in the stars. So they become obsessed with hoarding teeth, wearing trinkets. They've got jolly orc glyphs on their on their outfits.
Oh, that's so good.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Trophies of things that they've killed or taken. They often specialize in targeting, you know, vulnerable worlds. As you'd imagine, they're often recruited by other war bosses of other tribes because, you know, they're ultimately guns for hire at the end of the day, you know, and if they've obviously got the teeth to pay for them, they'll have the freebooters. They're predominantly flash gits because they're rich. And obviously you get, as you'd imagine, because they come from all these different walks of orc life, they're very varied in their appearance and the way they are. They often have combinations of like bad mechs, bad docks, Gorkanauts, Morkanauts, biker boys, and you know, even things like kill cruisers. So they're a very mixed bag of orcs at the end of the day, because obviously they're all the rejects from all the other tribes.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But can be you know, very powerful in their own way. So there's a war. So, Cameron, tell me how you gather a war together.
Well, let's see. Basically, there's a thing with orcs where, sure, eating's all good, drinking's all good, but when's we fighting? They need to fight just as much as they need to eat or drink. They constantly fight among themselves, they constantly launch these raids on enemies, but these things are usually small scale. But if the population reaches a critical mass, or if there is some catastrophic event that displaces them, or if they're being galvanized by a prophet or a particularly powerful leader, there begins this full-scale planetary migration. This is a war. They can be really long in the making. An orc boy could be visited by dreams of carnage and be inspired to rise up to lead his tribe, and, you know, as he grows as a war boss, both physically and sort of legendarily, more and more orcs will come to fight him until it reaches the point where all these different tribes will collaborate together. The mechs will build bigger and more outlandish machines and fortresses and engines of battles. Gorkanauts and Morkanauts become much more common, which that's saying something. Stompers and Gargans take shape. And, you know, they're unified by single leader. There's a lot of rivalry and infighting still. And basically, mechs that can't quite achieve the very heights of orcish mechanical doings will, you know, content themselves with making Killcans or Death Dreads or Battle Wagons. And, you know, eventually the war graduates from the continent scale to the planetary scale. And, you know, all the orcs in the local area will recognize the war boss is in charge. All the native populations will have been enslaved to manufacture ammunition. The mechs will sort of batter together factory ships and war hulks to transport the boys off planet. And when they can resist the lure of bloodshed on a grand scale no more, they basically hop on board their ships and blast off into the galaxy. You know, they'll land, there'll be smoke from thousands of oily engines, there'll be wheels and tracks and treads burning the ground underneath them, Gargants will be striding across. A true war spans from horizon to horizon, you know? It's a big, big thing. Eventually, you can't even see the battlefield for all the orcs, you know? That kind of thing. This is where you can feel the power of the war, like the power of the greenskin consciousness as like a wave of aggression, and Gork and Mork are believed to be gazing eagerly from the warp to see how the fight will go. Then, as one, they surge forwards and another planet is basically screwed. Yeah.
Nice.
It's pretty good. But, you know, how do orcs get around space, Matt? Because I said cobbled together, but just how cobbled together are we talking?
Well, it's the very cobbled is the answer, Cameron. as we know from all the history of the orcs, they've spread across the stars, despite, you know, the void being empty and very hostile. That, you know, that comes with it. You know, that hasn't stopped the orcs spreading. So I say spreading their seed, but spreading their spores across the galaxy. That's probably more appropriate. So they live on so many different worlds because, like we said, they're everywhere. You know, on these worlds, they're either dominating them. There's either a constant war going on, or they end up being slave masters of these particular worlds. In some cases, I mean, basically, orcs roam the galaxy on huge space hulks, creating empires across all these different planets. I mean, it basically comes to the point where humanity came across the greenskins, you know, tens of thousands of years ago. Like I said, they've been around a long time. And ultimately, that war that's still ongoing to this day in the 40K universe has no sign of ever stopping. So, yeah, so basically what happens is thousands of years ago, a probe was sent out from Terra to basically find life and explore and obviously report back. And basically that probe has been going for over 14,000 years now. Now, when the signals come back, which are basically in turn analyzed by Imperial tech priests,
it's always involved is orcish, basically. No matter what signals come back, there's some sort of orcish involved, which obviously the tech police have probably got used to by now, which basically means that the situation is now that all parts of the galaxy have either been in contact or will be in contact with the orcs. That's the bottom line, ultimately. That's what the probe is telling them, and that's never going to change. So, because of that, no system hasn't come into some sort of contact with them. So, like I said, we've touched upon, is the theory is that their spores travel, there is a theory, I should say, that their spores travel across the void cosmic winds. But realistically, the reality is that orcs have found different ways to travel and don't care where they go. It's where they can go and kill, basically.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Like I said, the sort of two main ways of doing it is, number one, like I said, I touched upon, is space hulks. Now, like I said, this is the main way that they travel across space, which is, like I said, a combination of, like, ancient wrecks and asteroids that have been sort of warp traveling for thousands or, countless amount of time. I mean, it's even some of these space hulks have got Xenos on them, they've got Chaos Renegades, but reality is most of them are ghost ships or ghost hulks, if that's the terminology. When a space hulk basically appears in orc territory, I love this, they draw them in with big tractor beams and basically turn it into a massive invasion ship, so there ends up being like millions of orc warriors. They create bays for attack ships and that sort of thing, basically make up the inside of this space hulk. Now they've just properly taken it over, and like I said, once it's ready, it goes back out with a fleet and generally a cruiser escort. You've got weird boys and mechs basically between the two of them, or group of two of them, basically aim it towards a warp storm and then let it loose onto the world. And the great thing is, it can randomly appear anywhere, which is obviously which actually in turn the orcs love, because they don't care where they go and they just want to fight. They just turn up anywhere. It's like I said, they leave it up to the warp to decide. And that's, like I said, where you can have a nice peaceful world. All of a sudden, bang, warps out the warp drops a shed load of orcs. The other main way they can travel is orc rocks, which are basically these big hollowed out asteroids that are fitted with guns and crews and things like that. They can't warp travel, even though I would say in a recent book I've read that may be up to debate, but I won't say any more than that. But at this point, they can't warp travel.
Can't intentionally warp travel, maybe.
No, okay, I'll be spoiling another book if I said more about it, but we'll stick to what it says. So they can't warp travel, so basically what they do within systems that are controlled by orcs, they end up having a lot of these rocks because they just churn them out as fast as they can, and because they can't warp travel, they travel from one planet to another, basically within a system. So like I said, the space hulks go out into the warp and the orc rocks sort of stay, local, so to speak. And they're basically moved around with these big, huge tractor beams. It's so orcish. It's great. I love them. It's
pretty good. Pretty good.
Right. So I think it was now moving on to the Green Tide section, which covers
We do have one of those lovely galaxy
maps. Yep.
But we're not going to go deep into that because it's complicated to look at, but it's a nice looking map. It shows you some of the big wars going on. There's a lot going on.
A lot of orcs. A lot of wars. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Okay.
So the Green Tide, this is that traditional sort of timeline section, which I really like in these books.
Yeah, I love these.
Yeah, so I'll start us off with the Lost Age, which is M15 to M31.
Oh, I thought I was doing that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Are you doing that?
Yeah. I'm doing the Lost Age.
You are doing the Lost Age. You start off with the Lost Age.
See, right. You're trying to put it's payback.
Yeah.
Right, okay, yes. As Cameron said, the Lost Age, which is M15 to M31. So this is known as the time of a faded mystery. Ultimately, orcs and greenskins don't really care about where they come from, because it doesn't really matter. Does that involve fighting? No, it doesn't, so I don't care. That's their mentality. So greenskins don't care about, like I said, keeping track of history, apart from their certain oral traditions and obviously the fact that Gork and Mork, like I said, they believe potentially made some brain boys, which are very intelligent orc boys, that in turn made the orcs. But again, that's up for debate. So the only sort of other real thing that gets looked at is that Imperial scholars, again, haven't really made any real information about this, but from what they've read from certain Eldari texts is that they're, the orcs are definitely linked to the old ones, which is a conversation for another day when we talk about the old ones. So from what they've gathered from where orcs originated from, they're sort of pretty confident that at some point a massive tragedy or a massive catastrophic event of some sort has basically ended destroying their leader caste of some sort, and then in a way has pushed them back, similar to what's happened with the Imperium, you know, with the whole Age of Strife and the Dark Age of Technology and things like that. It's a similar sort of situation where they've sort of been pushed back to sort of a primal, brutal race which only really care about war. So there is, like I said, suspicion that that's what they weren't originally intended for, but you know, that's the way that fate has given them. I mean, there's even records from the Dark Age of Technology that suggest that they were a tribal and marauding race back then, just like they were today, so maybe they always were that way, you know. One particular point to mention is Ulanor, which is that is what Armageddon used to be called, I believe.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
So this is a little bit of history. So there was a massive orc empire. I mean, basically the largest at that point that humanity have ever come in contact with. So the Emperor of Mankind sent out Horus Lupercal, quite a famous character, that Horus. Don't know if you've heard of him, to fight them, and to basically take on this massive orc warlord, which is by the name of Urlak Uruk. And ultimately, Horus does what he's meant to do and takes out this particular warlord, and then in turn makes the orcs' defenses, you know, basically submit. I think from memory, isn't that the turning point for him to become War Master?
Yeah, I believe. Yeah, that's why he becomes the War Master.
Yeah, I thought it was. So that's a particular era. So tell us about the Age of the Beast.
Yeah, the Age of the Beast. This is M31 to M32. A new war rising. So, you know, an orc warlord known only as the Great Beast, good title, sort of stirs orcs into action across multiple sectors, and humanity is really slow to react over this, because it's been a few centuries since the end of the Horus Heresy, and it's been pretty peaceful since then, actually. And suddenly there's all these orcs everywhere, which, and so the Imperium is really struggling to hold back the orcs, and this is where the orcs bring in one of their famous pieces of tech, the Attack Moon, basically a planetoid-sized battle station that wreaks havoc until the point where one is actually seen orbiting Terra itself. And, you know, a crusade is sent against this, and the Imperial death toll is absolutely horrific. Mankind appears to be on the verge of extinction, but there is an assembly of the Imperium's greatest champions, the Death Watch, is formed, and an important discovery is made that all of these invasions are stemming from Ulanor Prime, so the Imperium launches this last desperate attempt to fight back. They meet the Beast and his monstrous lieutenants, and ultimately, Imperial victory is assured. The orcs are defeated again, their most formidable leaders in thousands of years are slain, and their strength is scattered. And this sort of leads us... that orcs are always going to be around. Sure, they were beaten, but they'll always be back. Which leads us into the Age of War, which I believe I'm also handling.
You are indeed.
Yes, I did. Good. I had to double check. Here's one of my favorite orc characters that's been my favorite ever since I read about him years and years ago. Tusker, the Demon Killer. So Great Boss Tusker loves fighting demons so much that he makes a war straight for the Eye of Terror. He gathers all these like-minded lunatics with him and rampages across demon worlds inside the Eye of Terror before the gaze of Khorne falls upon him. Although the entire war was overrun and slain by these never-ending hordes of Khorneic demons, Tusker and all his followers were transported to Khorne's own realm, where they fight for all eternity, reborn every dawn to make war against Khorne's greatest generals for Khorne's own amusement. God, he's so good. I love Tusker.
Brilliant.
Yeah. The Ultima Segmentum is sort of almost overrun by these waves of greenskins during this time as well. Marnius Kalgar and the Ultramarines eventually save the day, as they always do. Gazbag is a speed freak warlord noted for dogged determination but not navigational skills. Guides his war towards some paradise worlds of the Eldar. The Bieltan craft world try to destroy the orcs, but find them to be too numerous and are eventually forced to retreat, with all those lovely paradise worlds ripe for settlement burned to cinders, effectively, and that's Gasbag's new empire. There is a small war of Dakar, where Warlord Grog Ironteeth leads a war against the Tau Empire, gathering up as much firepower as he can to counter traditional Tau tactics. On the world of Hephaestine, rogue trader Maximilian Trusk discovers some Archaeotech weapons from the Dark Age of Technology. There are some local greenskin tribes, but he fends them off with his own retinue. But a Lord Inquisitor Shale appears in orbit, demands Trusk's surrender the Archaeotech, and Trusk, being an untrustworthy rogue trader, obviously refuses. And for 3 months, the Inquisition and the rogue trader's private army are at war. Every now and again, fighting off some attacks from orcs. Until after, at the end of 3 months, this rampaging horde of greenskins just bursts out of the jungles and launches an all-out offensive from every direction, led by a stomper which smashes the perimeter, the defensive perimeters, and annihilates everything. And the orcs get some cool Archaeotech to scrap and loot, which is nice of them. Snakebite boss Hruk Tiefsplinter enslaves the entire population of his local system. Corva conquers 9 shrine worlds of Milesanct and uses the Basilica Imperator Majoris, basically the big grand cathedral there, as a breeding pen for his famously incontinent squiggoths, which yep
nice.
Yeah, nothing is sacred for an orc. The Kelshan Sept of the Tau reveal a new colony seeding ship called Hope's Light. On its maiden voyage, with over 300,000 Tau colonists and warriors on board, Hope's Light is boarded by an orc fleet led by Megaboss Morkrog and lost with all hands. For the next 10 years, the Kelshan Sept faces brutal raids from Morkrog's vast new looted warship, the Tau Killer. Which is great. Rise of the Weird War, I also like this one because it references another old orc character who isn't in the Codex anymore. A snakebite weird boy named Zogwart rises to prominence. He was born in a nest of blood vipers, and his blood is filled with these venom, and his clothes are covered in hissing snakes, effectively. His most amazing ability is he can curse his enemies and transform them into squigs. And this really inspires the tribe to fall in line after he squigs up the local war boss. he launches a very unconventional war, and replaces all the commanding knobs and bosses with other weird boys, and attracts all these mad boys, you know, these orcs that are a bit wrong in the head, even more so than odd boys, and forms this strange but undeniably potent horde to conquer planet after planet. which he was great. You then have the second war for Armageddon, which we all know and love. Gaskell Magorek Thraka gets his boots on, and meets his eternal nemesis, Commissar Yarrick, who we all love.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is a good one. This is the Lost War. Orc Warlord Grisguts is a noted kleptomaniac and launches his own war into the Morlock system. While using a warp rift to attempt to reach the system, he unwittingly travels through time and emerges from the warp just before he initially left. Hunts himself down and kills his double to get a spare of his favorite gun. This is so confusing to everyone he's in charge of that the war just stops in its tracks and basically self implodes. yeah.
How orcish.
Oh, orcs. Nazdreg, one of the Bad Moons warlord, bullies his mechs into effectively developing massively successful teleporter technology, and he actually bargains with Gaskell in exchange for an alliance.
Oh, nice.
A Dark Elder Archon Sharek from the Cabal of Severed Hope, seeks to use a local war hammer fist against a Tau Empire colony, and sort of lures the orcs to attack the world, but underestimates them. And the orcs use teleporters to essentially leapfrog ships around the Dark Elder force and ring them in and just tear them to shreds. Snagrod, the arch arsonist of Caradon, which, God, what a title.
That's great, isn't it?
Yeah, he unites all the orcs tribes in the Loci sector and attacks an imperial colony called Bad Landing. The Crimson Fists intervene, and Snagrod is unhappy about this and attacks their homeworld, Rin's world, destroying their fortress monastery, although the orcs are eventually driven off, the Crimson Fists are more or less completely destroyed. They're a sad, sad shadow of their former glory left. I mean, they've probably got a bunch of Primaris now.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah. The March of Gork is a war made up almost exclusively of Gorkonauts. Several hundred Gorkonauts band together, leaving the Empire of Bork to start a destructive rampage known as the March of Gork from one world to the next, to the mechs building more and more Gorkonauts from everything they destroy, sort of forming this tide of walkers.
That's great.
It's so good. You know, this is getting towards the end of M40 and M41, and wars are reaching these epidemic levels all across the Imperium.
Yeah.
And this ends up with the third war for Armageddon, where Gaskell comes back to Armageddon. Yeah. And, you know, that war's never going to end, basically.
Nope.
Because Gaskell's in charge, he's got a plan, so why don't you tell me about the Great War?
Yes, I shall indeed. Right, so yes, so we're now up to M41, the Great War. So let's start with the greater purpose. So yeah, so Gaskell, at this point, after the end of the Third War for Armageddon, is getting even more visions. Like I said, he's always had visions from Gork and Mork. That's how he's got to the position he's in. But as the Armageddon War drags on and on and on, he's starting to get more and more visions. He's getting head pains. He's getting lights coming out of his eyes and his ears and things like that. And it's ultimately due to the annoyance of Gork and Mork. So he thinks, you know what? Sod this. I'm going. So he basically leaves the Armageddon War to the generals under him, and he basically goes back to his particular ship, which is known as Killwrecker, to ponder, to think, etc. So, because obviously he needs to know what's going on in his head, so to speak. So he tries to understand these visions with, you know, by gathering warp heads around him, and he basically comes to a realization. He is the most ambitious orc there ever is. So he's like, right, I need to be doing something bigger than Armageddon. Armageddon is a small fish. I've just got obsessed with it, but I'm bigger and better than this. I need to be doing bigger things. So so ultimately, he takes his ship and those nearby to him to basically go and find whatever this greater thing is, which at this point, he doesn't really know what it is. So this ends up to the what's next, which is the Deadly Pursuit, which is basically, obviously, the High Command realizes that Gaskell has left. So Yarrick and the High Marshal of the Black Templars is basically chase after him. They thought, right, we've let him go before. We're not doing it again. So they basically go, right, let's go get him. So next is the Beast at Bay, which basically, despite the head start that Gaskell has got, they catch up with him because basically they got faster Imperial ships. So, I mean, we're talking within a few weeks, so it's not an overnight thing. So they finally catch up with him. And so in turn, Gaskell turns his ships around at a place called, which is called the Haunted Gulf, and basically charges the Imperial ships because he's just had enough of them chasing him. So as you'd imagine, you've got this massive void fight. You got some Imperial ships end up being crippled, but ultimately pretty much all the Orc ships get taken out. So basically as Yarrick, etc., go to board Killwrecker, it disappears in a bout of green energy, never to be seen again. And this is where we find out Gaskell's great task. So basically, this is where his visions are starting to come to a head. So his visions have made him disregard the loss of all those ships that have just happened. He's like, don't care about that anymore. And it comes to the point where he's got green lightning coming out of him. The warp heads around him are going crazy. And then ultimately the lightning out of his head hits the warp heads, and they end up turning into, you know, bursting into green flames. Their eyes burst, their skin starts melting, and then all the warp in this very creepy way, all the warp heads start speaking as one, and basically they're projecting the voice of Gork and Mork. And basically Gork and Mork tell Gaskell, they say, this isn't the time for you to die. You are to create the war of all wars, basically, to take over the galaxy. And basically, it will be known as the War of Gork and Mork. And basically, to do this, you must defeat every other warlord around, bring every orc under you, and then bring war to all areas of the galaxy to basically create the endless war for all the boys. And then after this message is given, all the warp heads die. Basically, all the electrics in his ship get fried. It cripples the Imperial ships that are pursuing him, and basically warp him elsewhere. He's gone. And left in his wake, the Great Rift tears through the galaxy. So, And then this is obviously the start of the Great War. So basically, Killwrecker appears in an area controlled by a particular orc warlord called Urgok de Slayer. Gaskell goes straight for his space fortress, because remember, he's got to take out or deal with other warlords. So he goes straight for his space fortress using, you know, surprise tactics, because that's the only thing he's got on his side at that point. Basically teleporting into the throne room with all the biggest and baddest knobs under his command. He rips through all the bodyguards of Urgok, and then basically invites him and say, do you want to join my war? and obviously, I mean, luckily most boys under Urgok will join willingly, but some have to join under submission, or in air quotes volunteered to be under Mad Doc Grosnick, Grosnick I should say. Obviously news travels, you know, and what ends up happening is the biggest orc migration that the, you know, the galaxy has ever seen, because obviously the, you know, news is traveling. And now basically with, you know, as of current day now, with an army, Urgok under him as a, you know, a servant of sorts, he's going for the orc empire of Octarius, as he needs more greenskins, and also he needs to show who's boss. So yeah, we shall see.
So now we're in 8th edition and the timeline's advanced. It's the Age of the Orc.
Age of the Orc.
Yeah, so Gork's grin widens. The Great Rift is essentially seen by the orcs as Gork's own smile splitting the galaxy. War is everywhere. Orcs are having the time of their life. The Great Rift is chewing up many greenskin empires, forcing wars to happen because they have to essentially leave or have their planet destroyed anyway, so they have to do this migratory crusade, effectively. And there are a lot of things going on, one of which is Great Expectorations, which is, if you remember old Zogwart and his weird war, they got swallowed up by the edge of a warp storm. Weeks later, Imperial astropaths in the Morrowgrim system experience a vision of the orc god Mork letting fly with a mucosally eruptive sneeze all over the capital world of Morrowgrim Prime. This is rapidly followed by the arrival of the weird war, with its warships covered in glowing green ectoplasm as they burst out of the warp. So essentially, Mork literally sneezed this war out of the warp exactly where it needed to go. Which nice. Is pretty great. Mad Doc Grotsnik took a warband of painboys, cyborgs, and specially modified killer clans to attack an isolated strike cruiser from the Silver Templars chapter and seized a number of Primaris Space Marines alive, but no one knows what he wants to do with them. Which, Primaris are having a rough time. Everyone's grabbing Primaris these days. Ariman's grabbing Primaris. Grotsnik's grabbing Primaris.
ooh, shiny. Yeah. That's why.
Ooh, shiny. Yeah, exactly. Imperial Strategos have identified several locations for Gaskell, which is concerning because he appears to be in several places at once. He appears to be inside the Empire of Octarius fighting Tyranid Imperial forces, but he's also seen sacking a planet called Cantissa upon the killing fields of Orokthar in the Imperium Nihilus and fighting around the Forge world of Ryza. you know, punitive executions decimate the command staff charged with tracking Gaskell's movements, even after it's observed that, as the Greenskins do use warp storms to navigate, it's entirely possible that time travel has caused several Gaskulls to be present at once. Which, God, the thought of that.
God, that is terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah. After 7 years of brutal warfare, the Rift Stalker, and the aid of the Rift Stalkers chapter, the forces of the Imperium finally defeat Chaos out in the Bargai Stars. A grand triumph is held, parades and martial celebrations. And war boss Gruk Face Ripper appears, floods the planet of Tremantics and Apogeo, before the defenders can rally, and, you know, plunges the Bargai Stars back into war. A warp anomaly, resembling an immense green fist, closes around the chaos world of Eisenfell. Freebooter warbands gather in the void to watch the fist crush these chaos gits, but instead are dragged in and plunged into a war with chaos on the surface of the planet as the world is slowly crushed by this immense fist, which, hey, that's something.
yeah, true.
There's just a hand of one of the orc gods floating out there in the galaxy, I guess. Warlord Nazrek's back, and he's decided to focus on the Farsight enclaves of the Tau. He's heard a lot of tales of the War of Dakar, and is dead set on proving that he's even shootier than the other orcs who fought that war. Mm-hmm. He's also heard of the Storm Surge Artillery Walker and wants to build one into a stomper. the Antonis Crusade in the Dark Imperium, crush local orcs and, you know, set out to reclaim the rest of the planets in the area. But the Night Lord's Legion shows up and, you know, starts attacking them and forcing them to fall back to the initial location. And it turns out, hey, you took everyone out on a crusade away from the world you just liberated from the orcs. Guess what? The world's covered in orcs again. it's not a good time. You literally caught between an orc and a chaos place.
Nice.
Yeah. Death Skulls from War Zort attempt to loot a Necron tomb world and accidentally trigger the entire planet's reanimation protocols. you know, all constructs are rising up by the thousands, but the Death Skulls, they're Death Skulls. They're just delighted. They scavenge and steal everything they can. They essentially turn the entire WAR into cyborgs and build even more Morkonauts and more improbable super weapons. They use a hijacked Necron Dolmen gate, so like a Necron warp style gate, to ferry in wave after wave of more orcs. By the time Overlord Thanpatek the Magnificent awakens to command his legions, all he sees is a mob of leering mech boys standing over his sarcophagus with evil gleams in their eyes and revving power saws in their hands. fair. The Crimson Fists are rejuvenated by an influx of Primaris Marines and start a crusade of vengeance against the entire orc race. And
can see that coming.
Yeah. And several WARs are sort of diverted to fight them in hopes of a truly apocalyptic punch-up. The Imperial World of Jaktor is about to be overrun by Skull Knights Chaos Space Marines when a Blood Axe Horde bursts out of the warp, crushes the Renegade Force, and then retreats to the edge of the system. The Imperial Defenders are a little confused by the fact that the Orcs attacked and then just left them alone until they realize with horror that the reinforcements they called for almost a month earlier will present the orcs with what they consider to be a proper fight. they do their best to send missives, like, don't come, turn around, but warp communication being what it is, doesn't really work. And a few days later, a force of Space Wolves and Frustroians arrive, and the orcs are like, yes, finally a good fight. And finally, Warlord Kruldaka, who you might have heard before if you've been paying attention to some lore, it descends upon the Imperial World of Vigilus at the head of an enormous speedwar. Yeah. The planet's vast hives are protected by force fields, and its Imperial defenders drive off initial assaults with ease, so the orcs build these vast scrap cities out in the wild and engage in deadly speed freak races across the planet's Dust Bowl deserts. Word spreads of a world where orcs can find the best races, and fresh hordes flock to Vigilus every week. So it is that, when the coming of the Great Rift collapses some of Vigilus's force fields, the subsequent greenskin invasions are catastrophically devastating.
Funny that.
hey, look, a little more info on what's happening with Vigilus. It ain't all smiles and rainbows.
No, funny that. I'm genuinely shocked.
Genuinely shocked.
End of part one. Go check out part two.